Yeah, so anyway, a few years down the road when we first get the glimpse that this crazy group of geeks that make up Studio Trigger, which, you know, if you look at any given Studio Trigger property, it's full of nerdy shout-outs and references and things like that. So that already gets you sort of excited. But based on that Gridman short, everybody was sort of in high hopes. And then what we see is that the title is going to be called SSSS Gridman, and we're off to the races in terms of they're going to be playing up some on a lot of nostalgia-y type of things for both the US and Japanese audience.
Yeah, well, that was the thing that kind of like I think like really surprised a lot of people was right, because they put in that SSSS, you know, Superhuman Samurai Cyber Squad Gridman, you know, kind of acknowledging like the American incarnation of this franchise, which is something that, like, you know, I know like a lot of Toei fans over here who grew up with Power Rangers are still kind of like pining for, is like Toei to make some kind of acknowledgement within Super Sentai that like Power Rangers exists, besides kind of like the slap in the face that we get in like a Kiba Ranger,
a powerful Rangers.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, you know, so that was, you know, to see Tsuburaya do that, where they were just like, you know, yeah, you know, we, by the way, we know that this show got an American adaptation, you know, so.
And so in terms of like the creative staff, like Akira Amemiya is one of those people where I was just like, okay, whatever, because his directing skills, like he's worked on a lot of really cool things. But if you talk about the shows that he has really to his credit, it is Ninja Slayer and Inferno Cop. And if you've seen those shows, you would, it's like, imagine if you were like, oh, there's going to be a new Disney animated musical. And you're like, okay, who's doing it? And they're like, the people who did Aqua Teen Hunger Force. Like,
sort of. I might watch that though.
Like,
I've never seen Inferno Cop, but I've seen it. It's something that I've occasionally catches my attention, because I've seen like one screen grab from it where like there's like this army of dinosaurs, and like a lot of them are very clearly like mashups of like Ultra and Toho Kaiju. Like there's one that's clearly some kind of hybrid of like Gigan and Ghidorah. So,
see, I'm getting sold on this like as we're talking about it.
Yeah, the animation frequently sucks, and that's a joke, but every once in a while it's beautiful, and that's also a joke, because it's the juxtaposition of the way that it looks. But yeah, those were both very cheap shows that Trigger had worked on. They weren't their Little Witch Academias or anything. They were just sort of to waste time. And you know, even like the Funimation release of Ninja Slayer has reviews on it like pure garbage, and
like that, you know, on the Blu-ray set.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's one of those very, very controversial things from, you know, because I'm sure a lot of people tuned in because they're like, oh, this is a studio that, not really, but sort of the studio that made Gurren Lagann, and it's not Gurren Lagann, but. So if it was just Akira Amemiya, that would be a little bit concerning, but like there are sequences in those things that show that he has the chops to make really beautiful animations, and the Gridman short is not the shitty animation that most like that he would do to be funny, basically. But if you look at the rest of the staff of SSSS Gridman, that's where you start getting a lot of really interesting talent that's pulled in. So you have Keiichi Hasegawa is writing it. He has major tokusatsu writing chops. I think really for the purposes of Gridman, he was the chief writer on Ultraman Nexus, which there's a lot of carryover in terms of a little bit in terms of themes, but also just in terms of little shout outs and tone between the two.
I'd agree on that. Honestly, like, you know, Gridman, the new one, I would call it kind of a spiritual sequel to Nexus in a lot of ways, like, especially in terms of, like, the theme, the tone, that sort of thing. Like, to me, even though it's the Gridman follow-up, so to speak, it also feels very Nexus-ish.
Yeah. It's one of those, you know, that's one of the big influences on it. Another major one, and this is controversial because the person that wrote this in ANN got some flack, sort of deservingly so. I think we all know where this is going, is that there's a lot of Evangelion in this. And you get flack because, frankly, it's a lazy anime critic thing to look at any mecha show and be like, yep, this is sure is Evangelion. I mean, they're robots. But no, there really are a lot of...
Lots. Like, it's... we'll get there.
Yeah. I mean, including the composer, Shiro Sagisu, also composed for Evangelion. And SSSS Gridman's interesting because the music is used sparingly, but it's very bombastic for all of the...
It's really well placed. Like, yeah. they moments, and it works so well. Yeah.
Yeah, it's one of those shows where it's like, I don't even know if I like it's one of those shows where you don't notice the music, and I don't mean that in like a bad way. Like, because it's like, it's so well integrated to like when it happens that it just feels like naturally like it's supposed to be there, including something that they do at the very end that Nomi and Connor have talked about.
So. Yeah, it's really awesome. They make it feel like a tokusatsu show. And that to me is something that when you're watching an anime, I just wasn't, there's a level of joy that I experienced just from that alone. And I have a question, actually. How much was Hasegawa, how much was he involved in Big O? Because I know he has some writing credits for that, but I didn't know how prevalent he was there.
I'm not sure.
Yeah, because, I mean, it was him and Konaka were involved with Big O.
That's one of my favorite things. Is great.
Big O is really Kanaka's baby. So, like, in terms of the writing half of it, so.
Yeah, I mean, when I look at the Big O credits, it's Konaka's the one that's credited first, and then Kazuyoshi Katayama. So probably Hasegawa is a little lower on the totem pole of that. But yeah, in terms of a lot of themes from, you know, people losing their memories to the world is maybe fake to things like that.
Also, a lot of comparisons. Goes into another show that Hasegawa did work on, which was 7X, which, not to get into Gridman or 7X spoilers, also carries a lot of those same themes too. Yeah. As which we'll get to, but point being, SSSS Gridman, there's a lot to it.
Speaking of Ultraman Nexus again, with behind the scenes people and actually a couple of other Ultra shows, they got Ichiro Itano on board to work on this show. And I don't know how many of you guys are into animation dudes, but Itano, there's a shot that you'll see a lot. It's sort of popularized by Macross, where you'll see a spaceship or something shoot a whole bunch of missiles, and they have different trailing smoke, and they all spin around, and it gets really convoluted. This is called the Itano Circus. It's named after him. So yeah, he was.
Oh, wow, they got him on it.
Yeah,
nice.
Yeah, and if you look at like the flying scenes in Ultraman Nexus, he worked on those also, and also Shinji Nishikawa, the kaiju designer who did a lot of the Heisei Godzilla designs.
Several Ultraman designs too. They also got a couple designers from Tiga and even one from 80 to return for the show.
Wow.
Yeah. Like, you know that big mountain kaiju?
Mm-hmm.
Designed by one of the 80 guys.
Cool.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah.
So yeah, like you put all these down and it's starting to get pretty promising, and then you watch the show and it's like, yes. I'm on board I wasn't on board from episode one, but from episode two, I was along for the ride.
Yeah.
Basically, yeah. How I felt too.
We can get into it, but yeah, it was, I think a big part of what sold me was actually the introduction of Caliber. So, but I guess I don't, does somebody want to volunteer to kind of describe, at least, I mean, we can go through maybe a little bit or slower, because there's this, unlike the tokusatsu where they kind of lay all their cards really on the table from the beginning, SSSS Gridman does present kind of an unfolding sort of mysteries. I don't know. Does somebody want to just kind of introduce us to like their characters from like the first episode?
I guess I'll do it.
Okay. Yeah.
So basically, the show starts off with Yuta Hibiki, and he's a high school student who has amnesia.
Oh, God damn it.
So poor Yuta Hibiki, he has no idea who he is or what he's doing. And he's found by his friends, Utsumi, who's basically all of us as a character. Like, he's a super big tokusatsu nerd, especially Ultraman. And he was my favorite character in the show. But he's found by Utsumi, and I'm trying to remember what her name was.
Rika.
Rika, that's it. I didn't want to say, So he's found by those two, and they take him back to school, and then a kaiju attacks Gugulus. And then later on in the episode, Yuta fuses with Gridman. And unlike the past Gridman shows, Gridman appears in the real world like Ultraman. And he fights the kaiju, and then over time, you're introduced to the main antagonist, which is kind of an interesting subversion or reimagining of Takeshi Toto in a few ways. And you're also introduced to the weapons, too, which, unlike the original show, they are now people. They go into the computer along with Yuta Hibiki to become the various weapons that he uses to fight the monsters with. And then over time, like, the show builds the mystery of like who the main villain is, what their motivation is, why the world is the way it is at the end. And it leads to a very satisfying conclusion, in my opinion. But that's the basic gist of it. If you haven't seen the show, I think we're going to be going into spoilers pretty soon. So if you want to see it now, without being spoiled, go watch it now. We'll and listen to this later. Please.
Well said. Yeah, so the first episode, the way that things were going, it was really hard to get a gauge on quite what was going on. And I think going back and rewatching it, having seen the rest of the series afterwards, I've watched through this twice now. You do pick up on things that you wouldn't have necessarily picked up on in the first viewing, or you would have noticed and thought, well, that's weird, and then forgotten about. But it's one of those ones where there are some strange directing choices that I still don't fully understand all of them. And there is some mystery type of stuff that seems to be set up that they never totally addressed. But I think that ambiguity is one of the reasons why this show is fun to discuss to some extent. But yeah, you do start with your main character waking up and he has amnesia, and oh, he had some interaction with this girl earlier, but he doesn't really know what it is, therefore we don't know what it is, and we might never know what it was. But they go to the hospital, the same hospital from the original Gridman series. It's the Inoue Clinic, which was Yuka's dad, played by Bon Daisuke, worked there. But he goes to the hospital. They're like, I guess you just have amnesia. Go sleep it off or whatever. So he's promptly just sent home to his house where he has no parents because they are overseas or something. And everyone just sort of goes with it and treats it as no problem, as well as his evident hallucinations, because he keeps seeing that he's seeing a figure talking to him out of this old busted up computer that's at the antique shop where Rika's mom works. So everyone is pretty, you know, sort of cavalier about this whole thing.
Which is, it's the same old computer from the original series. It's the junk. So, and it's like now residing in like this old, yeah, I mean, antique store. It's weird because, yeah, I guess Rika's mom runs sort of like, you know, I don't even know if it's an antique store is the right term, but it's basically just like a bunch of crap that people don't want that she's trying to sell. That's also, she also has a cafe where she apparently makes food and drinks for people. So though evidently nobody goes there.
Yeah. How are they open? I don't know. There was no customer for the entire series.
They don't seem to have a very successful business. So it kind of reminded me of the shop that, Noda's dad ran in a Fooly Cooly, but anyway, that nobody seemed to frequent. So,
so yeah. So when like Yuta's getting ready to like leave. There's some weird animation cuts. It's not entirely strange directorial decisions. Then later when he's at school, there's something that it seems like it's a very odd moment where there's just a 20-minute freeze. It's you know, there's a, well, in the original Gridman, there was a whole episode about special dogs, which are these, you know, hot dogs that we talked about before. Mm-hmm. Somebody gives him one, it gets smushed, and then there's a 20 seconds of just silence. And
rest in peace, special dog.
Yeah. So it's like one of those, oh, is this going to be like one of those like goofy anime, like, ha ha ha, this sure was an awkward scene. It's only later that you realize that in that moment, someone in the room decided that someone else in the room had to die. So...
oh yeah, there's a much higher body count in this Gridman than the old one. Just for you people going to watch it out there, which I think that might be a good segue to the main antagonist.
Because another thing I noticed is this first time around that the first character that you see in the first episode is this purple haired girl who's staring at the sky. And you don't think of much of it in the first episode because she's barely in the first episode. She appears there, and she appears when she tries to hand over a hot dog. And aside from her character design, there's not much notable about her. But once you get to the next episode, everything reveals itself.
So this purple-haired girl is Akane Shinjo. So who is and we can talk about this more later, but in terms of her character, it bears some emphasizing right here. But Gridman is a show that has some fantastic character design, and in particular, it seems to have some almost lethally great female character design. So both Rika and Akane, as far as anime girls are concerned, are like 10 out of 10s. But so that is important to bring up right here, because so Akane is this very attractive girl who is in our protagonist class along with them. She is very bubbly, very popular. It seems, you know, everybody seems to like her. So very much the opposite of our Takashis or our Malcolms, who we've mentioned before. But then we quickly learn that she is sort of she's like them in the sense that she appears to be very affluent, very well off. She lives in a gated home that seems quite nice, and she is also, as it turns out, much like Sho, a huge kaiju otaku. We see her home, or her room and her home, which is just full of display cases that are full of all kinds of, and again, this is the sort of thing where if you're a nerd about this kind of stuff, you can freeze frame it, and it's like she has like not just kaiju collectibles, but like super obscure specific.
We're talking
kaiju.
Guys from like Ultraman Powered and Ultraman Great.
Right,
that kind
right.
of stuff,
like, mm-hmm. like collectibles and stuff, you know, and yeah, she goes home every day. She logs onto her computer, and just like Takashi and Condigifer, Akame is talking to this evil computer being called Alexis Carib in this case, who is you know, having her instead of having her design monsters on the computer, she sculpts them. I'm not sure out of what exactly.
She had like wires. I'm guessing it's like wire and clay, maybe.
Yeah, it's like wire and clay. She has like a box cutter that she uses to like carve them with. It seems
I do have like a pet theory that the second Ghoul Gillis had like King Joe's head on top. So I'm wondering, did she like sacrifice one of her King Joe figures for that?
She's a kit basher.
That could be. Yeah. Anyway, but yeah. So she's so she makes these monsters, and then Alexis Carib brings them to life. But again, like we said, instead of it being them being viruses that attack things in computers, they're kaiju that appear in the real world and specifically target people for murder, who Akame has decided that she doesn't like. So in this second episode, you learn that she She attempted to give this hot dog to Yuta, and these girls who were off in another corner of the classroom playing with like a volleyball, and lost control of it. It by accident knocked the hot dog out of their hand and smushed it, and then Akame made a giant dragon monster to kill them. Because it's and that's the sort of thing. I mean, if we want to like start getting into like her character, I mean, that's the thing that's sort of like really interesting, I feel like, because we sort of talked about how like Takashi, like 99% of the stuff he did was like motivated by like really really petty bullshit, that then had these sort of like over the top kind of like consequences and stuff, but like there's something about the execution of it, I think, in the original series where it's almost kind of comical, whereas in this anime series, it actually becomes like I found it to be a lot more disturbing and a lot more sinister the way Akame goes about it.
Well,
I
I'd agree too. Because it's
I
like,
agree, but that also sort of makes it comical to me because I'm sick in the head. The idea that somebody's like, "Oh my God, they said that this was Baltan and this is not Baltan, and I've got to go right now and then murder them." Like that's.
well, I don't think she murdered those guys specifically because they didn't they misnamed a kaiju. I think that didn't help their case, but
I
in
think
her
if Kevin
mind.
were Akane, that he would probably murder them.
I think
Someone says something bad about Gudis in my house. I gotta say, sending something bad to them.
But I mean, it is that sort of petty stuff of that, like her teacher bumped into her and didn't apologize or stuff like that.
Yeah, there's yeah, if you've seen the show, you know this, but yeah, there's a later episode where like Akane gets drugged along with Rika because like these other girls have basically gotten like an invite to like spend time with like these group of guys who are like YouTube celebrities or something, which I mean I think sounds like maybe stupid to us because of our
Oh,
generation, but I believe it for
man.
them. Yeah, like these like YouTube celebrities or whatever. So, and like Akane doesn't really have any interest in this and doesn't want to go, and like it doesn't seem like Rika really does either. But it's like Akane decides that she's just gonna murder all of them so she can get out of this. So, because it's like a waste of her time. So.
Yeah,
But, yeah.
she's really entertaining, and I think it speaks some volumes that Crunchyroll just had their anime awards nominations go out, and she was one of the characters that was nominated as best villain of the year, along with All for One and a few other characters I can't remember off the top of my head, but that it made that big of an impression on anime watchers in general was like, yeah, this is an interesting character.
Yeah, well, and she gets more interesting as like the series progresses. So like I think one of the first things like and I think we're gonna talk about Akane a lot because this is something else that's like worth bringing up, which is that like honestly like Yuta Sho are not particularly well developed characters in this show. Rika is a little bit, but it's primarily Rika's relationship to Akane that gets really interesting. But like Akane is the villain, and she is really the most developed character in the entire show. She
She's
is like,
the villain protagonist. This is her story,
it
and
is her story,
we'll get
yeah.
to that in the finale. But she is literally she is the most interesting character. It's her story.
She's also literally the most important character.
Yes, like she is kind of God. Spoilers, by the way. I'm sorry.
We've said spoilers enough times that
yeah, we're
it's
in
too late.
spoilers.
Yeah.
Yeah, so yeah, Akane, yeah, so she's yeah, so she, Gridman shows up, defeats her kaiju, and she gets really upset about this, and so she and I'm trying to remember, is it episode 3 or 4? When is Auntie introduced?
Three. It's three.
It's three. Okay, yeah. So in episode 3, she creates this kaiju who very much seems to be, I think, at least in terms of design and stuff, an homage to Shimbalar, the ninja monster from the original series.
I'd agree, and I also think in terms of like appearance and role, he's also very similar to Zedden And then as yes. well, I think he's basically Juggler too from Orb.
So yeah,
and,
she,
you know, one of the Transformers, but we'll get to that.
Yeah,
I can't comment on that, unfortunately.
Yeah. But so she creates this monster called Anti, who's basically the only purpose of Anti is to kill Gridman. Like that's the whole thing. He's designed to be the perfect foil for Gridman in terms of like a monster. And he can also assume human form is the other thing that's really interesting about him. And so, you know, it becomes this whole thing where like you get this almost kind of like mini drama within this larger series, because of course what happens is like Auntie fails to kill Gridman in their initial conflict, but he's not defeated, or he's defeated, but he's not killed. And so, you know, because this is his only purpose in life that like Akame has given him, like he becomes this recurring protagonist throughout the entire series where he keeps constantly popping up, you know, with this desire to kill Gridman. And because he's like completely unsuccessful, like Akame kind of like, you know, has like, you know, she jilts him and turns him away and everything. And she's like, you know, you failed me and everything. And you get this sort of like Frankenstein kind of drama going on in here where like Auntie's only purpose is to like please Akame and, you know, kill Gridman. And, you know, his creator has like rejected him. So that's also a really interesting part of this show.
He's got a little bit of a Hakaider type of vibe going on.
Yeah. I could see that too.
Oh yeah, there you go. Yeah, Hakaider, definitely. So
very classic sort of toku feeling character.
Did anybody? I don't know if anybody has any really strong thoughts about Auntie as a character. Well,
I actually really like him.
Yeah,
yeah, I do too. Are we talking about plot points? Because I feel like that ties into a lot of how you feel about him.
I think we could bring that up too. So Auntie, when I was watching the show, because he was like the first kind of big bad monster, and the fact that Gridman got his shit kicked in as early as episode 3 was kind of cool. And, you know, I thought he was an interesting idea for a villain, especially when Utsumi was like, oh, what if the kaiju are people? What if, you know, whoever's doing this is turning people into monsters? And I really like that idea because it kind of feels sort of writer-ish in a way, or ties back to like something like Ginga with the Spark Dolls. But then Anti shows up and his dynamic with Akane and Gridman himself was really interesting. And then I think we have to bring it up, what he eventually does. He becomes a Gridman, which was totally unexpected, but really, really cool.
Well, they set a precedent for it, because the thing about Auntie is, like I said, like he's designed to be like the ultimate foil to Gridman. And so the thing that he can do is he can mimic any of Gridman's abilities, right? So like when Gridman gets like his power up where he can like shoot a bunch of missiles, like Ante grows a bunch of spikes that he can then shoot, right?
Or when he flies, Ante will fly, that's
right
of thing. Like,
exactly. So they set up this idea that eventually does come to fruition in the series, where Ante actually fully transforms into basically kind of like this Gridman doppelganger, and he becomes Grid Knight.
So Grid Knight technically did return.
Mm-hmm.
Just about 20 years too late. But
there's also the idea that he, as the show progresses, he becomes more and more human. And there's something like directly opposite of that I don't really want to talk about right now, because it's in the final like episode that happens to Yuta. Because it's like it's kind of like this weird, very unique dichotomy. And there's a thing about Anti that like he's kind of annoying at first for me, because like he keeps showing up. And, like, you know he's just going to get his butt kicked. But then the more that it goes, the more human he becomes. He starts saying – like, he's learning to speak more words. He's learning how people act. At one point, Rika gives him a bath because he smells – like, he's homeless. And she stumbles upon him, like, in a – like, feeding in a dumpster or something. She feeds him, and she ends up, like, giving him a bath because he doesn't – it's very clear he has no idea what humans do and how they act. And as the series progresses, he becomes very likable. And I love that character progression in him.
And we should also talk about the fact, because this is some of the stuff that we were talking about earlier with the Tokusatsu series really starts to play into this, where having seen the original Tokusatsu series, starts having like real benefits for what you're understanding is going on in this series, there is a point where Ante is, you know, again, like Matt said, he's homeless. He's like wandering around in the streets and everything. And there's this episode where he runs into this, or no, actually that's later. Never mind. I'm sorry. I'm thinking about towards the end of the series. Okay. Never mind. That's later. Okay.
But there's another thing we haven't talked about yet, and this is kind of a recurring plot point, right? It's the idea that the monsters attack, nobody can see the monsters in the fog, and then when a monster does attack, people vanish. Nobody can remember anything about the city being destroyed. The people are sometimes gone, but nobody remembers that people existed in the first place. Like, everybody starts having these amnesia, but the city always ends up being fixed the next day, and that's a constant thing that happens throughout the show. And then ultimately it's this idea that like the person behind that, why they're doing it, like it's Akane's motivation for doing the things that she does and how that plays into Ante. Like, that's kind of what worked for me in the whole dynamic. Are we going to spoil the end? I feel like we need to go through almost like a plot rundown.
Okay.
I think we're going to spoil the end, but like, yeah. I think we're trying to like build towards that a little bit.
One of you guys should like take just a basic plot rundown so like we can talk a bit more about it.
All right. So basic plot rundown. There's an episode, I think it's episode 6. It's the one with Anoshilas where she returns. Whatever episode that was. But in episode 6, Yuta meets Anoshilas, who is a kaiju from the original show, the friendly one who was living in the computer, who meets with Yuta and explains what this world is. And she's like, oh yes, this is a world where Akane is God. She created this world and everything in it. And when she sees something she doesn't like, she just destroys it and then quote unquote resets the world basically with these kaiju. And, you know, from the start I was thinking, yeah, with the kaiju and Gridman, the real world, this has to be set in cyberspace or something. And then it's revealed over time that this is a simulation of everything. And over time, with her continuous defeats at the hands of Gridman, Akane's mental state begins to slip hardcore. And then in the penultimate or so episode, she stabs Yuta.
Yeah, she figures out. Yeah, so Akame is like going through like most of the whole series trying to figure out like who Gridman is, and she starts getting these suspicions that Gridman is somehow connected to Yuta and Sho and Rika, and they start figuring out that Akame is connected to the kaiju, but they don't initially really know how. And then yeah, they do eventually figure out that Akame is the one making the kaiju, but she hasn't quite figured out what the connection between them and Gridman is. And I don't remember exactly what episode that is, but that's one of the ones that's like, you know, where you start getting like the dynamic between them, and like it gets like really chilling because it's the episode where, again, like classic like anime cliche or whatever, right? You know, it's the school festival episode, right? Mm-hmm. And and they're gonna, you know, so like everybody's like gearing up for like the school festival and stuff, and Akame comes to school with you know, her one of her kaiju sculptures, and you know, basically gets Yuta, Sho, and Rika in like a room by themselves and plops this thing down on a table and basically just like lays her cards on the table, and she's just like, this is my next monster, it's gonna kill everyone at the school festival, try to stop me, motherfuckers, you know. That's what she does, you know.
She's such a jerk. Like, another earlier thing, when she meets with Yuta. So in the first episode, she kills a character named Tankawa, and Yuta goes to the restaurant that Tankawa's parents run and was like, hey, what happened to your daughter? And they're like, oh, we don't have a daughter. And you know, this is really messed up. So of course, when Akane takes Yuta out to dinner to sort of like put her cards on the table a little earlier than that, which restaurant does she take him to?
and that episode is like really crazy too, because that's the whole thing, is like, yeah, they're having dinner at this restaurant, and not only is like this whole situation already kind of like messed up, and like, you know, they're sort of like feeling each other out as like antagonist and protagonist, but like Akame also invites Alexis to the restaurant, and like, I've, yeah, and so it's, that's the other thing.
Oh, go on. No, I was going to make a comment, but go on. It's not that important.
I was just going to say, I mean, which is one of the things that's really different from like Con Digifer and stuff, is that apparently Alexis, like, well, again, we see can like enter into the real world or whatever. At that point, you know, you still think that this is the real world. You don't quite realize yet that this is a world that's actually a computer simulation that Akane has made. So then suddenly that makes more sense. But I've seen a lot of people refer to that scene, and it's absolutely accurate. It's the scene of Yuta meeting Lexus Carib for the first time is basically him meeting like Akame's dad, like the girl you're dating.
Well, it's such a dissonant scene also, where like you're sitting in a restaurant and this like 8 foot tall dude with a flaming skull comes and sits down at the table, and the waiter just doesn't like flinch.
Like, I think if I could compare it to like any scene I've seen in Tokusatsu, it's the scene when Dan and Metron sit down for the friendly chat in Ultra Cell.
Oh yeah.
Because you kind of have this weird looking alien motherfucker show up and is like, yeah, I'm conquering your world and everything, yada yada, talking to the hero, and they're just sitting at a table. They're not fighting or anything, and they're just having a good chat. And it's such an odd and surreal moment in both those shows, and one that catches you off guard, especially if you've been watching more serious stuff. So you're not really expecting, and it's a lovely little touch to the program.
Go ahead, Matt.
Oh, I'm changing the subject. So if you have something important, go for it.
Well, all I was gonna say is, like, you know, going back to like the dynamic with Akame and stuff is like, you know, one of the things that's really important that ends up happening here is the fact that, like, you know, once Yuta and them realize that Akame is the one making the kaiju, you know, and like basically the ones that they have to stop, you know, like Yuta and Sho being the guys, their, you know, attitude is basically just like, okay, well, we have to like take the fight to her, you know, and Rika is kind of really appalled by this idea that they're basically like going to like, you know, get into a fist fight with one of their classmates, let alone this girl who she's been, you know, I you know, they're not really friends per se, but, you know, I guess, you know, like really good acquaintances or something, you know, a classmate of theirs, you know, and so there's this whole really interesting thing that happens in some of the later episodes where Rika's like, you know, okay, let's try diplomacy, you know, let's try and like reason with Akane, you know, and show her like what she's doing is like wrong and everything. And that starts to get into some of like this really interesting stuff too, right? Where like around the same time that Yuta is meeting and also I have to clarify something Connor said earlier, because my understanding is that the girl that he meets is not actually Anilis, that kaiju. It's supposed to be like Anilis's daughter. So
yeah, it's Anilis too,
right? Which I have questions about, but anyway, yeah. And around the same time that Yuta's figuring out that they're living in a computer simulation, like Rika's finding out this information from Akane, because Akane is basically telling her, like, you know, yeah, of course you want to be my friend. I programmed you that way. You don't have a choice, you know.
We're going to come back to Akane, obviously, but yeah, we haven't mentioned the Neon Genesis junior high students. I feel like we should probably talk about them, because these are the students that are the characters that ultimately become the additional weapons and armor for Gridman. And they basically have their own little morpher thing, and they go into the junk computer. And when they do, Gridman gets, you know, a new ability, whether it's a sword or, you know, what have you. So, but obviously the name cracks me up the first. I was like, they were just so on the nose with all of the Ava references.
So I don't know if you're aware of this, Matt. So there's actually some controversy about the fact that Funimation translated that as Neon Genesis Junior High Schoolers.
No, man, that is news to me, because like everything that I saw on both the interwebs, which is always true, plus Wikipedia,
always true.
So
if
so,
it's on the internet, it's right. That's how that works.
My dad works for Trigger. He knows what he's talking about.
So what it is that the phrase that's Neon Genesis would more literally be translated as New Century, which is the name of the first episode of the original Tokusatsu series, New Century Hero. And so there's this question about whether that's actually supposed to be an Eva joke or whether they're supposed to be making a reference to the original series there. And so yeah, should it be New Century Junior High Schoolers?
I wonder, because like there's so many other what I would consider visual references to Ava, though. Like,
yeah.
Oh, yeah. There's a similar thing where there was a You Are Not Alone, which is, of course, the name of one of the Evangelion rebuild movies, but it's also a line in the original Gridman theme song. So, you know, and, it's...
But yet there is some stuff that's clearly supposed to be, like, a shout-out, because, like, there's that one shot of, is it Akane's, like, notebook or something where it has on there...
It's Utsumi's.
Is it Utsumi's? Okay, yeah, Utsumi's. Like notebook that says like gods in or the phrase from Nerve
gods in heaven all's right,
all's
with,
right
the
with the world right yeah so
well I also took stuff like there's something I must do like kind of riffing on the Shinji's I mustn't do this crap like the mm-hmm. back and like those kinds of things but it's the opposite and there's a lot of that in the show. Can we talk a bit more about the Neon Genesis / New Century characters
yeah.
that we have.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
So we Samurai Caliber, Max, Boar, I guess Boar. I'm not sure how I didn't watch the dub, so I'm not sure what they call
it. I think it's just Boar.
Yeah, Boar and Vit. Boar is Boar and Vit are both from Superhuman Samurai Cyber Squad in terms of where they got the names from, right?
I believe so, yeah.
And these characters are, you know, to an extent, you know, sort of channeling that because it's they're human characters walking around in the world until they go into the computer to also appear in the world as weapon power-ups for Gridman.
Yeah, because like you mentioned that earlier when I was talking about the adaptation. Yeah, because in Samurai Cyber Squad, you know, right, Sam has like four friends instead of just two, like Nota, and they are the ones that become like the attack weapon pilots. And so in this case, they've got these four kids who become then just the actual attack weapons. Like when they're in, you know, before they go through the computer, they're kids walking around or whatever. So, you know, but then, they transform into the actual weapons and stuff. And yeah, Samurai Caliber, who's the one who transforms into Gridman's sword, is like the first one who's introduced and is probably in some ways like the most developed out of them. Max, who's the tank, and Vit, who's the jet, don't really say or do too much. Boar gets some development because he's kind of a jerk.
Especially to Utsumi.
Yeah, especially to Utsumi.
I think the fact that Vit doesn't do anything is sort of his development. Is he's always like the one that's like, I'll go out, I guess, if people tell me to.
I'm a jet.
That's true. But Caliber is this great character who is the one who really got me to like the show. And so I have to talk about this. So and this is a little bit of a. There's a personal connection to why I really liked Caliber. So his whole shtick is so all of their shticks is like, you know, they're all dressed in black, you know, they've got this kind of like sort of almost goth look going on or whatever, the members of them. But Caliber's specific thing is like he not only turns into a sword, he's also like carrying around like four katanas on his back. And he has a lot of trouble going through doors. Because like he's constantly getting caught on like door frames, like with his swords, like trying to walk through and everything. And also, you know, like that's not a common sight in Japan, is for people to be walking around like carrying a bunch of like katanas and stuff. And so like, you know, when he's out with like Yuta and them, they're always just kind of like a little edgy because they're like, you're walking around with weapons to get guy, you know, and you know, he tries to like follow them onto like school and everything, and they're getting like, you know, weirded out and stuff. So part of the reason why that character is so hysterical to me is that I know those people or that person. I won't name anybody, but so a really good friend of mine, she dated this guy who was basically like an open carry nut, but with samurai swords.
Did he also run like Naruto?
Probably.
He studied the blade.
Yeah. I mean, but that was the whole thing. Was like that was literally like me and my girlfriend would try to go on like double dates with them, you know, because like, you know, she was, you know, this was a really good friend of ours, you know, still is. And, you know, she was dating this guy, you know, and we'd just go up to this restaurant and he would just have a katana on him. You know, and we'd be like, you cannot carry that inside, you know? And it just, it was a really big issue. I mean, she told us like he tried to take one to like her family reunion that she invited him to, you know? And so like, you know, it was, and it, you know, try to take them into malls and everything. And, you know, and so like, it was literally this thing where like when Caliber shows up in this show and like, that's the whole joke is like, he's carrying around like four katanas. I was just like, oh, it's him, you know? Like, so that character was like hysterical to me for that specific reason. So
I didn't think those people actually existed. I mean, I've seen the memes on Facebook.
Yeah.
I have been corrected.
Oh, yeah. No.
I feel like I've learned something wonderful today.
Samurai Calibers exist in our world.
It's like finding out Santa Claus is real.
Like, it's, you know, I mean, in terms of like, I will say, in terms of how this guy like dressed and cut his hair, he looked a little bit more like Ante than Caliber, but otherwise, you know, yeah. So,
well, the Neon Genesis Junior High students in general, I think they are over the top. And I mean, even just watch the opening, they're the ones that are like, oh yeah, this is a trigger show. Mm. So like, if you've seen Kill la Kill or something along those lines, he's like, okay, yeah, it's those guys. And they definitely like spice up the proceedings quite a bit because, as we mentioned before, like Yuta, Utsumi, and Rika are all sort of like not as they're a little on the bland side.
Mm-hmm.
They are also the only ones that are freaking once they're all introduced. They are also the only ones who are keeping Rika's mom's cafe / antique store open.
Yes.
So because they basically just start living there and like ordering food constantly and stuff. So.
And then Rika's mom starts calling one of them handsome.
Yeah. So yeah, no, they're great characters. So
I guess that brings up one of those questions is about how they function in the grander scheme of things. Once we know all of the twists of the series, is that, you know, Gridman, when he arrived in the world, was split, and it seems like they are all parts of him. But maybe not. Like,
so
I like it was stated kind of explicitly that they were that's yeah. What it was.
Yeah, they came from Hyperworld. So I guess because if you remember the original Gridman, Gridman's not his original form. Like, he takes on that form based on the hero they drew. So I'm wondering, like, when they went to this world, if those guys they decided to take on that form as well as the armor form, since they're like electronic beings or something. I'm just spitballing there.
That's possible if they took on the forms of something of some, maybe some guys that were already running around in the system.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I mean, it would make sense that, like, I mean, I guess that sort of makes sense because, I mean, you can also sort of rationalize like with like Ante and then also even Anocelus the Second later is like, you know, I mean, because As we've already got into, and we can get into this more, right? So like this whole thing we learn is an artificial world that Akame has actually created. And, you know, we later learn that like her reasoning for this is like basically she's trying to make this like a perfect world. Like, she was unhappy in the what is actually like the quote unquote real world. You know, and so she's trying to make like a perfect world for herself. And of course, like, her perfect world is because she's a teenage girl, you know, it's still oddly enough like a high school, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, so like, but everybody that exists in that world then are like high school students or teenagers or people who exist in some sort of capacity. So like, I guess for the idea for like these attack vehicles, if they want to be inconspicuous, like, oh, we're going to become a group of junior high students, then it's like, okay, you know.
Yeah, they don't look like junior high students in terms of, like,
no.
I mean, particularly no. Max has, like, this big, like, metal thing over his mouth. It's like,
you could just say it's, like, one of those, you know, dental headgear or something.
I suppose.
I don't know what these things are called, but it's like I've seen people at conventions wearing them. So
a fake Bane mask.
Yeah, because it's like yeah. I mean I've seen those before at like.
We call ourselves the Neon Genesis Junior High students.
well, now you just sound like Tim Curry. So.
Oh man.
You know, no, Tim Curry as Bane would be pretty cool.
That would be pretty awesome. There's another aspect. There's like another aspect of the show with like there's always these monsters in the like in the cityscape and wherever they go, you can see them in the background, but you can't really get to them. And I kept thinking like what the hell are those things? Because they seem like I thought at first they were just there for basically just like fan servicey kind of thing. You find out there's actually a reason. Mm-hmm. It's the fact that because Akane's created this world, you can't actually escape the boundaries unless she gives you the ability to do it. And there's a fog that these monsters basically emit that prevents you from leaving wherever you're at. So you can only go so far. And then at one point, those monsters do get destroyed and they see everything for what it really is. They see like it starts looking like the Tokusatsu show where you have the more Tron-y aspects and different things. So yeah. I was glad to finally see that revelation because I wasn't really sure what to make of it. I didn't know if it was like, oh, this is Ultraman 80 where there was a monster in the background and they show it beforehand all the time.
And there were specifically the monster Venera from the original Gridman that has a poison smoke attack. So there's all of this fog that is sort of shrouding the city and making people forget. And
in that episode with Venora in the original show, that's the episode where Tom Digifer broadcast the battle between Gridman and the monster to the public into the sky, which I think is a reference with them being seen in the distance. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I haven't officially heard it been confirmed to be Venora, but to me, it's Venora. Like,
so another potential sort of major influence on this that I read into it, and maybe this is just because I'm such a big fan of this film, is the second Urusei Yatsura movie, Beautiful Dreamer. Who other than me has seen this?
I have not seen it.
Okay.
I have not seen it. We've talked about this.
So. Oh, man. Okay. So, Beautiful Dreamer is... it's an Urusei Yatsura movie, so it's set in this pre-established continuity, but it's basically it starts with the characters getting ready for the school festival. They're all at high school all the time, and they're like, man, it feels like we've been getting ready for this festival forever. At least it'll finally be done tomorrow. The next day they say the same thing. The next day they say the same thing. And eventually they start to get suspicious, and they're like, okay, well, we can't just stay at the school forever. Let's go home. And they try to leave town, and they can't leave town. Like, they get into a taxi, it drives them in a circle and drops them off at the same place where they were before. Then they, you know, over the course of the movie, you figure out that, oh, one of the characters is having a dream. This character wants to have an ideal life and is just getting rid of the characters that they don't want to be part of their ideal vision of things. So like a romantic rival or an annoying teacher will just sort of disappear. And the other characters, some of them will be concerned, but the rest will be like, okay, well, we're having a good time. Let's just, you know, keep having fun. And eventually this person has to wake up. So, I mean, that's very high level Beautiful Dreamer in a nutshell. And
well,
I was
describe Gridman.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah,
so
I mean,
especially the ninth episode, I feel like there's some of that going on. I would definitely suggest all you guys watch Beautiful Dreamer, but Godzilla's in it also.
Sold.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think we talked about this not that long ago. I mean, I've only watched like a few episodes of Urusei Yatsura. I'm butchering that. But yeah, I mean, you know, which has mostly been at stuff that you've talked about, Kevin, like, because, you know, I watched the whole episode that's basically Gamera Guardian of the Universe before Gamera Guardian.
right.
So, yeah.
But yeah, I mean, I even noticed that, like, in the comments section, because I watched Gridman on first I watch it on Crunchyroll, then I watch it on Funimation, but there were like comments and like Beautiful Dreamer LOL or whatever. So I do think that that was part of what was going on here, and there was definitely sequences in it, like the bit in the Anacillus episode where Yuta's on the train and then he gets off the train and he looks up and the train map, it's like this stop Tsutsuji Station, next stop Tsutsuji Station, previous stop Tsutsuji Station, like stuff like that is very sort of that phantasmagoric type of, you know, dreamlike state. And yeah,
which I mean stuff like that's been done other places too, you know, because I mean some of that stuff reminded me of I don't know how many people here have either read the book or saw the movie adaptation of like Neil Gaiman's Coraline. So
right,
because yeah, I mean that comes up in there as well, you know, where it's like, you know, oh, you're in this perfect world where everything's to your liking, and then it's like, oh, you know, you can't actually leave this world, and you know, you think it's like really big, but like you've never actually tried to like leave your house, and like once you get more than like 50 feet from it or something, it's like it just loops back around. So
I also really, really appreciated in the whole episode where Akane is trying to basically pull one over on our three main characters by giving them these perfect dreams, that it's particularly Utsumi, who's just like, oh no, this is good. Is too good things don't happen to me.
Yeah, that was pretty funny.
I also just have to ask, has anybody ever had that dream that Utsume's having?
Where you just find a bunch of merchandise or something, or
yes.
Oh, I mean, my god.
That's my dream every night.
I've had so many like weird merchandise related dreams when I started getting back into Godzilla and started collecting, you know, kaiju tokusatsu stuff. And like I'd always wake up when I'd find something really cool that doesn't exist in the real world that I want. Like my favorite one though was when it's a toss up between the time that a local supermarket in my town somehow got Ultraman as a mascot, and they'd have like Ultraman versus kaiju fights in the parking lot with guys in suits, or the time I found Jet Jaguar sneakers and I was about to buy them. I was about to pull open my wallet and then woke up.
See, I've been to Mandarake in real life, so you know it's all.
Yeah.
Look at you.
I've been to their web store. Does that count?
Yeah. No, that was. I mean, it's one of those things where like, you know, that is like really eerily accurate for somebody like Utsumi, because yeah, I mean, I've definitely had those dreams. I've had dreams about being in bookstores, you know, where, you know, it's like, you know, it's just like, oh, there's all these books that I want to read. It's like, I didn't know these things existed, you know, and then it's like, I'm just like filling up like a cart or something. And then like at some point, you know, you wake up and you're just like, oh, son of a bitch. So that was a dream, wasn't it? So.
Well,
and it's such a weird, like specifically nerdy thing to like dream about, because it's like that should not be someone's surreal fantasy. So, because it's not like you're like going around like, you know, it's not like you're in a bookstore like naked, or you're in a bookstore like writing out or something. It's like you're literally just dreaming you're in a bookstore.
There's a go ahead.
Yeah, well, especially also. One of those nice little Easter eggs that they have, and we'll do at some point a rundown of our favorite Easter eggs in the series. But in that scene, when the monster that Akane gives to Utsumi, the figure, it was the
Bakugan.
Yeah, Bakugan
from Tiga.
Yeah. So this is specifically a dream world monster. So this is something that like it's a nice little like signifier, like, oh, this is something that's fake. And also earlier in the episode, she's playing with two figures, you know, one
she
is
had
the,
a,
the cyborg,
yeah, robot chief.
Yeah.
From and Ultra as well. 7.
Yeah.
Mount and Gulliver was in it too.
Yeah.
They so also this... talk about Ultraman like constantly.
Yes.
Throughout the, like they just like, oh, what would happen if this were an Ultra show? Like, that's a question that's actually asked verbatim in the show.
And I like that, though, because, like, in real life, if kaiju and a big, you know, guy that looks like Ultraman showed up, we'd be like, oh yeah, this is like Ultraman, right? What would happen next if this is like Ultraman?
I actually thought it was kind of funny.
It's not that annoying thing that you get in, like, you know, zombie or vampire shows or movies where, like, these things show up and nobody's ever apparently heard of Dracula, you know? So
yeah,
right.
Like, there's tropes throughout the thing where, like, they blatantly talk about how, like, no girl in high school likes monsters. Like, there's a whole, like, conversation about the fact that women aren't fans of kaiju, even though the main character is obviously a fan of kaiju. But, like, there's all those kind of, like, tropey things that I thought they were kind of endearing, really.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, and that's part of, you know, why Akame is, like, able to throw them off for so long, right? Because it's like, you don't expect a girl to be into kaiju, and you don't expect a girl that looks like Akame to be into kaiju, you know, so, so yeah, you know, and then, so it takes them, you know, I mean, it's only 12 episodes, but, you know, I mean, they do that well, that, you know, it takes them a while to catch on that it's her, you know, and then even after they find out, there's, like, this initial period of sort of, like, disbelief and everything, so
and she's on to them a lot faster than they're onto her, and I mean, really, she's the one that does most of the revealing to them,
right? Though yeah, which is in part, well, she catches on to them pretty quickly, but that's the whole thing, is it's like, yeah, I think a lot of the reason why she reveals herself to them as it goes on is because she is trying to, she, it takes her a long time to figure out, like, what the exact connection is, because, like Connor was saying earlier, it's not until you get to that penultimate episode where Akame finally puts it together that, like, you know, Yuta is actually, like, Gridman, which is something at that point that, like, Yuta hasn't even fully figured out himself, you know, and so she, you know, she just makes this, you know, bold decision. She just walks over to his house and Rika's house and stabs him, you know.
Well,
so
she knew earlier than that. She sent Auntie out to murder him with the express instructions of, like, hey, kill this him. Guy is Gridman, you should kill him.
Right.
But,
she does
at the
it
same
so
time,
nonchalantly too. It's hilarious.
Yeah. But she didn't, you know, she didn't know all of the mechanics of it, because she was like, well, how come when we went out to the mountains that I made somewhere, they didn't transform right away. What's up with that? And, you know, so it's, I think that might've been a little bit of hesitation on that side.
Yeah.
And also, I don't think she knew that strong of a connection between Yuta and Rika was a part of it as well. You know, that, because she has an interesting relationship with Rika, which, I know. I guess we could dive into that subject as well.
We could.
Yeah, I mean, if we want to start getting into, like, everything that happens in, like, the climax, I guess, like, the only other thing we could sort of discuss is, you know, I mean, same question from, like, the original one was, like, you know, was there any particular work with, like, the kaiju designs or, like, later sort of, like, the mecha stuff that really stands out to you? So,
Yes.
A lot, actually.
Nanashi, like Nanashi, the anonymous kaiju, the, like, the play on man in suit.
Yeah.
Like, he was really good.
The otherworldly, like, it's got this, like, look, spike-looking thing coming out of the back of its neck, and you don't realize it, but there's actually another monster beneath the skin or flesh, and the way that it, like, roars and moves is so otherworldly and super creepy, and, like, it reminded me, especially the second form of, like, Grisa, just, like, the mechanics of it from Ultraman X. That was probably my favorite monster of the whole series.
I liked Devadon, the monster in the second episode. He's got kind of a, you know, the clear head with the eyes like a submarine fish. I think that's what they're called, pilot fish.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know what I'm talking about?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, he was cute. He's one of those monsters that, like, you look at him and you go, that's a good design. That communicates, you know, what kind of personality or, you know, that he might have. I did like Ante a lot too. He might be my favorite, but I don't really count him.
Right. Yeah. That's
he's
a,
kind
like,
of like
I
a...
want to buy a toy as soon as it's available.
Yeah. Who else is there? Like you mentioned Anashi. Gulgulus Mark II was pretty cool. Because he was kind of like going off of how, like, the kaiju, the original show, would come back and be redesigned and have upgrades.
I like the Deriver, I guess. That sounds a lot like the Digimon thing, but the one that's like a marionette controlling it floats in the air and has all of the like string puppets that it that was very, very Evangelion feeling.
It also did feel like a nice little nod to that's how UFOs move in the old Ultra shows. So
that brings up something, because I think that's the episode, and Kevin, you might be the best one to recap this, but I don't know, does anybody have any really strong feelings about the allegations of plagiarism placed on this show?
I've heard about it. I think it's, again, I haven't seen any of the Brave shows. I don't have a dog in the fight, but I think it's kind of pointless.
Kevin, do you want to describe what that is?
So I think in terms of the controversy, it's one of those things that was overblown. But basically, it is one of those things that they reuse a lot of animation cuts because they like doing tributes to things. We haven't stressed just how many Easter eggs to various nerdy properties there are in this, but there are a lot. So when they, recreate an entire sequence, it's of my mind that it's definitely more of doing it as a tribute. However, there's a really fantastic animator, Masami Obari, that basically redefined the look of a lot of mecha shows in the 80s and 90s, and a lot of people had just sort of assumed that he was working on this. and because, they have shots that, like, okay, this is just a recreation of a scene from Dangayo or something like that. And, they're doing it because they're fanboys, and I can understand that. There's not anything new for them. Like, they do shit like this in Evangelion and so on and so forth. However, basically, Obari got onto Twitter, or maybe it was his wife got onto Twitter. It wasn't even, like, Japanese Twitter. It was, like, Chinese Twitter or something. And got tweeted some sequence of animation. And he made some comment like, guys, there's a line between homage and plagiarism. And it might not have been those words specifically because translations get fuzzy. But definitely that was one of those things that really took off. And I mean, it is a conversation worth having. Like, how many people are going to look at this cool thing that they're doing and think like, oh, this is the shot that Gridman invented. So, I mean, this is something that makes some sense, that you don't want to just have your show be a giant ripoff. But sometimes, I mean, it happens. I think it happens in art a lot. If you look at Star Wars, you don't just be like, oh man, this sure is like plagiarizing Ray Harryhausen work. Even though, I mean, it's using stuff that's in Ray Harryhausen work, right? So,
Well, I mean, I think even the better example is, Star Wars and like Kurosawa's Hidden Fortress. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I mean, structurally, Star Wars has that going on. But I'm talking about like with these like cuts, this is like very superficial type of things, when they use the exact same angle, but it's in something else. So,
there's a couple cuts that are like 15 seconds long that like are frame for frame the exact.
Yeah, and I mean, this is like as an otaku, you were watching like, oh yeah, that's a scene from the Dragonar opening or whatever, and like, it's cool, but I could understand also why if like you're the person that originally came up with that thing, you're like, oh man, that took my thing. So there's two sides where I don't think it was anything that was done maliciously or like intending to. I think that they would fully acknowledge everything like that. If it were brought up to them, I don't think that they were trying to pull a fast one or steal other people's work. I think it was just, them celebrating things that they really liked.
It feels like as reference heavy as the show is to other things, like it's more of a, I would lean on the homage side rather than just like, oh, I'm going to take this one scene and we're just going to redo that.
Yeah. Like if the show is many things, but like, usually if you think of like, oh, this just took this other thing and recycled it whole cloth, usually you think like, okay, that's something somebody does when they're lazy, and this show is not lazy. Like, no. It puts so much
Yeah.
Like, you catch more things watching it a second, third time through. So I think it's, if anything, it's more of a an attention to detail that goes beyond. And again, not anything unusual for this studio. I mean, if you look at the ending credits to Kill la Kill, they're the same as the ending credits to Sukbandeka, except they're animated. Like, the, you know, transformation sequence in Penny and Stocking happens to sync up perfectly with the transformation sequence in Sailor Moon, you know, stuff like that. So,
right.
So we should probably talk about the last couple episodes and how it ends.
Yeah.
Good idea.
We haven't got there yet.
So we got as far as Akane stabs Yuka, and so yeah. Then
world is kind of coming undone. Like, the cyber buildings we see in the original show are starting to show up now, mostly because the that kaiju we were talking about, the guy was like, what's his name? Anashi? There we go. Anashi killed them, and things are going to shit. And then a lot of stuff happens. A lot of stuff.
Well, I guess we can start with Yuta sort of wakes up. Except, is it really Yuta that wakes up? Do we ever actually see Yuta?
No.
In the entire series?
Yeah, that seems, I don't know.
Yeah, much like the whole thing where Ultraman hijacks somebody's body and then they have no memory later when he leaves it. It turns out that
I was going to say, Yuta's eye color changes.
Yeah.
Yes.
So he goes from being blue-eyed to, he wakes up out of... Yeah, so he gets stabbed by Akane, and they take him to the hospital, and he's basically in, like, a coma, which... They even throw out a line there where, like, the doctor's just like, usually being stabbed doesn't put you in a coma, you know? So, they're not sure what's going on. But, yeah, when he wakes up, he now has, like, golden eyes. And, you know, he's basically become, like, Gridman, you know? And so it's sort of like, it's like he was, it's that weird sort of thing where, he was possessed by an alien, and then the alien had amnesia. So
it's kind of like I mentioned this show earlier, kind of like Ultra 7X, which I'm about to spoil this 12-year-old show, so I'm sorry. But now 7X is kind of a similar show to Gridman. Hasegawa worked on it too, where it's kind of like a world where it's not seeming like the truth is out. You know, it's not. There's stuff hiding beneath the surface. Our main character has amnesia, and he can turn into a big hero. And then over time, well, we'll get to that in a minute, because to me, that's the big reveal of Gridman. But I got some major Ultra 7X vibes from the ending myself, where it's revealed Yuta's really is Gridman, because I was thinking, oh, he's possessed by, like, Ultraman, like Naoto. And then it's like, kind of, but not, well, he is, but the Yuta we know doesn't really exist. That was always Gridman.
Right.
But some of Yuta's personality comes through still, they say, you know, that's why he still, like, has the hots for Rika and et cetera, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
But, he's sort of a construct, as are a great number of characters in this, as it turns out.
Well, yeah, because it's like, because my understanding is, like, just to go back to, like, the Yuta thing, it was like, basically it's like Yuta was a kid in this world, you know, but, like, he was Gridman ended up like possessing him, much in the same way that, like, you know, some of the Ultras will possess their host, or specifically, like, Seven possesses, you know, Dan, and you know, but then, yeah, like, something went wrong when that happened, and so, like, Yuta has, or Gridman forgot that he was Gridman and started thinking that he was Yuta, who had to merge with Gridman. And it's only in the end that he realizes that he has actually always been Gridman, right? You know.
And I'm sorry, Justin. I can't let that Seven possesses Dan rest.
Seven makes a copy of Dan.
Right.
Okay. There's more like 7X, where 7 possesses Jin or whatever his name was.
Yeah. Right. So.
But, and then during it, Akane is, she's losing it. Alexis Karim feeds off her negative emotion, makes her a kaiju. Lots of other kaiju shows up, and he's fighting them all. Yuta wakes up as Gridman. He joins the rest of his friends, and then I think we need to talk about the moment.
Well, I was gonna say before that, because basically what happens is like after Akame stabs Yuta, like she's not in a great like mental state or emotional state as it is, but then she's like completely kind of like done after that, and she basically goes off to go sulk by herself, you know, and Alexis is, you know, like, he's like, well, I don't really need you anymore. Like, you've made enough kaiju, and he brings back all the kaiju that she's created, and Yuta's in a coma. So Auntie is the one who shows up in his Grid Knight form to kind of like fight them off. And there's some great stuff that goes on where kind of like Auntie like actually shows up at like Yuta's bedside while he's still in his coma, and he has to like convince the other characters to like let him help them, you know, so because they don't trust him. So, and I do feel like I want to talk more about Auntie's character like later on, but then eventually, right, so like Rika goes off to find Akane, at which point then like they're having like this sort of like heart to heart about everything that's happened, and then there's this great moment where Alexis Carib shows up and he's just like, let me interrupt this pointless conversation. So, and he's like, I still need Akane, you know, to like make kaiju, and she's just like, I can't, and he's just like, yes you can, and he turns her into a kaiju. So
in the Funimation dub, the guy that does the voice does an impression of Tim Curry for Alexis, and it's pretty fantastic. My only qualm is that the one time he slips in a meat thing, he's talking to someone who is not a meat thing, but you know, that's a quibble.
See, I have to watch the dub then. So, because that's the other thing, right? So that's what you were getting at, Kevin, is like, so then in like the final episode, like, so Akane as a kaiju is off fighting like Grid Knight, and Rika is left with Alexis, and you know, they're kind of having this conversation where Alexis is like, why would you do all of this? Like, why would you want to like hurt Akane like this? And Alexis is just sort of like, he's like, you don't get it, do you? He's like, this is a world that she made. You're all her, you know, basically subjects. None of you really exist. You're all like digital constructs, you know? And it's like, and you know, he's like, I didn't do any of this to her. Like, she reached out to me, you know? So, which is sort of like one of the big reveals, which there was again some like controversy about that Funimation kind of flubbed that in their subtitles, because I think it's like Alexis calls Rika and all of them like replicants instead of using the term from the original series, which was computoids. So basically telling them like you're not real people, you're, you know, basically like Sims. So
right. I mean, the gist of it still comes across. It's just right. That little Easter egg reference type of thing that maybe provides a little extra nugget of continuity, which I mean, I wouldn't worry about too much. The subtitles that you get from Super Ion, the original Gridman, screw it up too. So
this is true.
But yeah, so Auntie is fighting against Akane and in her kaiju form, and we get a. Would you say this is more Gamera 3 or Ultraman Nexus?
Yes.
I give it a solid Gamera 3.
Evangelion 3.33.
All three.
Will not
all
finish.
Three at the same time.
Yeah, basically, that whole sequence where, like, Auntie basically, like, reaches inside of, like, the Akame kaiju and, like, pulls Akame out from inside of it, which is, if you've seen any of those three movies and or shows that we just mentioned, there's a very similar scene. So
which doesn't totally help, because then Alexis immediately stabs Auntie and absorbs her himself, but I
will say that the first time I watched that, because like I haven't watched the whole series all the way through again, but I've watched certain episodes, and I did watch the final twice, and you know, initially I thought that seemed a little redundant for like Alexis to turn her into a kaiju and then immediately like absorb her so that he can basically become like a kaiju. But I realize that that's really like that scene is really there so that you can have a kind of conclusion to sort of like Auntie and Akame's like story arc, you know, of like this, like the creator and like the creation and everything. Cause you get that dialogue between them where once he rescues her, you know, and like she sees him now and like the fact that he's become like a hero, and she says to him, boy, you know, you really are a failed creation. And he's like, yeah, you should be thankful for that, basically. So
that goes back to something I talked about earlier, where like he becomes more human, and then like Yuta ultimately becomes Gridman, which is, we learn he's not human. So it's like that weird, I thought it was a cool dichotomy. Like, I'm not trying to read too much into it, but like I really liked the progression of Auntie's character in that way.
I would argue that after like Akane, like Auntie is oddly enough like the character that gets like the most development, and I think it's really interesting that he is like a kaiju. There's certain things about his character, and I don't know if I know Kevin's, I know Kevin reads it. I don't remember if you do, Connor, or I don't know if you do, Matt, but the Xander Cannon's comic book series Kaiju Max.
I haven't read it yet.
I've heard really good things about it, though.
It's phenomenal, and you know, I mean, it's basically doing like a prison drama, but with giant monsters. And you know, Cannon does like some really interesting things with like the way he uses the kaiju as like characters to like develop them as like a commentary on like how, you know, people develop in society and stuff and everything. But there was some stuff with Auntie where I was getting flashbacks to some of that comic with, you know, like the whole thing where, like, you know, when he shows up by Yuta's bedside, like the other characters don't trust him, and it's almost like this discriminatory sort of thing, like just because he's a kaiju, you know. And there's that great line, that was the line that really made me think about Kaiju Max, because there's that line in there where, like, you know, I think it's actually Boar, like the one who's like the little jerk, like says something to Auntie to the effect of like, you know, it's like, you know, you crush like so many people or something, like every time you show up, and like now we're supposed to like, you know, expect you to help us or something. And like Auntie's response is just like really flippant. And he's just like, he says, I can't fight effectively if I'm constantly worrying about where I'm stepping.
Yeah, that part was pretty funny.
Yeah.
Gave him this like horrified look, and they're like, what? That's yeah, the worst.
Yeah. You know, but I was just like, that's like, but, I mean, because it made me think about, in a weird kind of way, it made me think about like that famous Honda quote, which Cannon has said is like part of the underlining theme for Kaiju Max. But that famous quote from Honda where he's like, you know, kaiju aren't evil by choice. They're too big and they're too strong for like their own good, you know, in a weird way. Because it's like, yeah, I mean, if you're a giant monster, and you're trying to like fight to like save people, it's like there's going to be a lot of collateral damage, not because, you know, you're an awful thing, but because you're a giant monster. So
I did like also Utsumi's participation in that scene, just of like that, like, who the hell's this guy? Like, I'm a regular person.
Yeah. And I guess like, I feel like that'd be like a really, There's some interesting stuff going on there too, like, because we could talk a lot about, you know, Akame and Utsume, because like there is this whole sort of weird thing going on there with the fact that, like, you know, they're both like these kaiju otaku and stuff, you know, and like, you know, they there's some interesting sort of like commentary there, right? Because like Akame is obviously kind of like, you know, really fucked up, like, you know, down to like her core and everything, you know, and so like she gets this perverse pleasure out of like sending giant monsters to like rampage through the city and like kill people she doesn't like. But you know, you have this moment towards the end of the series where Utsume gets like really upset, and you know, he says, you know, like, because he's a fan of this kind of stuff, like he really enjoyed like every time like these monsters would show up and Gridman would fight them, you know, even though he knew that like people were dying and like the city was being destroyed, you know. And so like he feels like almost complicit in it. And so there's this weird sort of like commentary on like our own fandom, which like I know me and Kevin have talked about a little bit before in the past, you know, which is like, you know, kaiju is really weird like that, because, you know, it's the closest thing you can sort of compare it to in a way is, it's, you know, they're like disaster movies, but where on a weird level you're supposed to be like rooting for like the earthquake. So
yeah.
And I think it's, you know, it's presented here almost as like a, here are different points on a similar spectrum, where Utsumi is maybe like the high functioning otaku, where he's a little enthusiastic, he's basically good hearted and maybe a little pudgy, whereas Akane is like the dysfunctional, like lives in her room surrounded by bags of trash and like staring at her monitor all day.
Yeah, that was something that we didn't mention, which is I know we had like some talk about it when we were setting this up, because like that was something that like I never totally figured out during the whole thing, was it was like, yeah, like her room, in addition to having like all these like display cases full of kaiju figures, is also apparently just full of trash bags.
It's visual shorthand for hikikomori.
Right. Mm-hmm. I mean, I kind of got that, which was still also weird because of the fact that she does actually like leave her house, whereas like the defining aspect of hikikomori is that they don't leave their house. So, you know, I'll tell you what it also reminded me of, which was really weird. I don't know how many people besides Kevin here have seen Audition. So
I've seen it.
Yeah,
I'm not, but it's on my list.
I mean, it reminded me of the girl's room in Audition. So, which is if nobody's seen, it's a movie by Takashi Miike about. I don't know if I want to spoil it for Matt, so but yeah.
I know he needs to see it.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I mean, I love Miike stuff, so I'm sure I'll get there. I have to kind of prepare myself, though, because I also know a bit about what it is.
Yeah. So, there's some visual continuity there, so I'll just say that.
But I think that's, you know, when we see her there, that's when she's in her element. That's where she's being her true self and not like the facade that she puts on for people out in the school environment, which is also interesting because there's no reason for her to be putting on this facade to interact with people that she made to love her anyway, but she still does that. And I think that's interesting.
I think there's some explanation there once we get to like the very final scene.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of ways to interpret that for sure.
So I guess we should get there. So like Connor was saying, So Alexis absorbs Akame and so then like basically assumes his like final like true boss form. And so him and Gridman get ready for their final fight, and I'll let Connor talk about it, I guess. So what happens?
As someone who's seen the original show and loves it to pieces, everyone access flashes, they enter an SSSS for, what was it again, Justin? Special Service to Save a Soul or something?
I think that was right, yeah.
Yeah, something like that. And it's revealed, and this was something I've been hoping for, that the Gridmen were following in the show. And to people who are just tuning in and haven't seen either show, well, watch both. But this might sound a little confusing, that both Gridmen are the same guy. It's the original Gridman. This isn't like Gridman X or Sigma or Grid 7 or whatever. This is the original deal, the real deal. He's back to baby Dan Dan. And like, I've seen a lot of tokusatsu, and there's a lot of moments that I think are really cool, but I think that might be one of the coolest in any of them, any of the spinoffs. And then they fight, and, you know, eventually Gridman wins. Akane is saved.
I think it's worth mentioning how he wins, right? Mm-hmm. Because, like, that's one of the things that, again, if you're not familiar with the original tokusatsu series, I know there were some people who were complaining that because they weren't familiar with the original series, they thought this seemed like some kind of like cop out because they didn't realize the continuity going on here. And this wasn't mm-hmm. something we really talked about earlier. But what I'll say is, so like Alexis and Gridman fight, and they're pretty much evenly matched. Like they're not, you know, with Alexis kind of coming out on top, you know, and they basically fight to like a standstill. And, you know, then so the thing is that Alexis, we find out, is immortal, right? Like he can't be killed or destroyed. every time Gridman lands like a killing blow, he just regenerates. And he actually explains, and this gets into something that I think like me and Kevin will probably talk about here in a little bit, but he does explain that the that's actually kind of like been his motivation, is because he's like, because he says something like, you know, because I can never die, it has left me with a great emptiness inside, and so therefore I seek out people with intense emotions like Akame, you know, so that they can like help make me like feel something, you know. Mm-hmm. Which like Gridman responds to is like, that's the most selfish thing I've ever but you know, what ends up happening is, so in the original Tokusatsu series, every time after Gridman would win and he would beat the kaiju, he then used this a power that was called like Fixer Beam, where he could repair all of the damage that the kaiju had done to the computer, and basically like do a hard reset and everything would come back to normal. And so because our Gridman, who we now know as the original Gridman, is still kind of like overcoming his own amnesia, like something happens where at the very end he remembers that he has this like grid fixer power, and so he uses it on this world that like Akame has created, and that's actually how he ends up beating Alexis, is by basically like just doing a hard reset and reversing everything. So because he can't actually kill him because Alexis is immortal.
Yeah. Like, and it was so satisfying to see that too, because I mean, I saw the original show when it premiered on Toku last year. Wow. So it was still fresh in my mind when that happened, and it was just I don't know. It was like watching a show where that I saw a long time ago, and then it came back unexpectedly. Just that little moment, that little piece of continuity. Like, I've still seen a lot of people like debate about, is this a sequel or not? It's like, no, this is a sequel, man.
It was obvious from like episode 6 that it was a sequel.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think the only people who aren't saying it's a sequel are the guys who are like unfamiliar with the original show, which is unfortunate, because I think if they like this show, I think the original show is worth checking out.
Yeah, I mean it's definitely a sequel, you know, and you know the other thing is, of course, like, you know, when Gridman assumes his like original like Tokusatsu form, you know, they play the theme song from the original Tokusatsu mm-hmm. series, which is interesting because I believe it was we already mentioned like Shinji Nishikawa like did a bunch of kaiju designs. And I remember like when the show first premiered, because I follow him on like Facebook and stuff, like he posted a video during, because like there were actually people I remember like saying, and this is like included, I think like Japanese fans, like when the anime first premiered, they were saying like they were kind of disappointed that it didn't have like the theme song or something. I remember him making a post on Facebook about saying like how many people feel like Baby Dan Dan is Gridman. Like those two things are inseparable, you know? So, and like, there were like all these people being like, yes, absolutely, absolutely. And he was just like, well, you won't be disappointed. So, I was asking you early, Connor, like who did that song for them?
I messaged you about that. I think it was Noroka. Give me 1 second. I'll pull it up. I'm lazy. Norio Sakai.
Does he have a lot of like, you know, like Toko music better than I do. I mean, does he have a lot of like previous like Ultraman credits or like?
I don't believe he does. I haven't really heard him aside from Gridman.
Because it's, I think that it's a really, really good theme. And it sort of makes me, I'm wondering if it's a situation kind of like a Super Robot Red Baron, where they got somebody who doesn't usually compose like television music to do it, which is, you know, that's part of the reason they say like Red Baron's theme is so good, because like they got like a professional quote unquote like musician. And like I know like that guy, the guy who did Red Baron, whose name I can't remember either, has even said like, yeah, I wrote a song that was quote too good for television, you know, because I mean Red Baron's theme is also like kick ass. So.
Yeah, Red Baron, we should do it. A talk on Red Baron sometime, but I think I'd have to rewatch it, have it be fresh in my mind.
Yeah, when that anime finally gets subtitled.
Someday.
Well, we can talk about the original series and the German compilation film for the sequel.
We can also hope for
which was on Amazon Prime recently. I don't know if it's still there or not.
And Brave Storm is awesome. So
I need to see Brave Storm so badly.
Yeah, I still don't know where you're supposed to watch Brave Storm.
A friend of mine actually imported it. I don't think he's watched it yet.
Didn't you see it at like a? Didn't you see it in theaters or something, Kevin?
I didn't see it in theaters. Amanda saw it in theaters. I got the Blu-ray.
Oh. Okay.
Oh, okay. So I just Japanese Wikipedia. Norio Sakai. He did the ending theme to Kamen Rider Black.
Hmm.
And he also did some stuff for Car Ranger too.
Okay. Yeah. Black
Car Ranger, really Mega Ranger, Ginga Man. Wow, he did some Kuga too in Akito. All right, so he's done some stuff, but
well, I mean, I'm also seeing here that you know there's the singer and there's the composer that are different people in this case. So who gets the most credit for the theme song? You know, the composition, the arrangement, or the song? You know?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, well, the whole thing works really well, so.
Yeah, it's one of those things where, like, you say Gridman, and you're tempted just to go Baby Dan Dan right after it. It's like, every time somebody says Kamen Rider of Dragon Knight, you're like, together we will fight the fight. So.
Or whenever someone mentions Kuga, I always just think, no fear, no pain.
Yes.
Kuga's such a
good show. Or, in my case, like, yeah. You mentioned like Time Ranger, and I'm just like, go over time and space.
Yeah. Or Car Ranger, Car Ranger, Car Ranger.
But yeah, I mean, when they did the Boys Invent Great Hero event, they held off on the Baby Dan Dan until the very end is like a moment of triumph. So yeah. I'm not surprised that they did that same thing here. And I mean, it's a catchy song. Like, you'll see people that are just doing a review of the anime, don't know anything about the tokusatsu, they still use that song for their reviews because it's fantastic.
It's a good song. Like,
yeah.
I think if they used the song earlier in the show, that moment would not have as much power.
Yeah. But actually, I would argue that just as powerful is the following scene where they use that instrumental version of the ending theme.
That piano is fantastic.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I mean, we get that huge, big, like crazy studio trigger fight with traditional animation. Like, they've been using sort of like CGI for Gridman a lot, but I think with the simpler design, they're just like, nah, we're gonna use it like properly, hand drawn animation with all the squash and stretch that you would come to expect.
Well, that's the other thing too, is like, because we kind of like alluded to that earlier, but like, you know, and. There are videos online that like really break this down well, but like one of the things that is really striking is like the fights in this between like Gridman and the Kaiju feel like tokusatsu fights. Like, they're very limited in movement and like how everything is done. And other than the scenes, like what we were talking about earlier, where like they're done as like kind of more of homages to previous anime and stuff, like this, you know, they're pretty tame in comparison, especially to stuff that like you're used to seeing like Trigger do in like Kill la Kill or something. And but then this end fight is very much a Trigger fight. So
like there's a thing about the fights too, that the buildings don't crumble. Like the buildings like fall over kind of the way that they do in the tokusatsu shows. Like, they don't like they made it so like you're watching that in anime form, and I really appreciated that. Like, at one point a monster picks up an entire building. Obviously the physics of that don't work, but it just like tosses it at Gridman.
Right.
Yeah, and you know, again, like you said, it's been covered elsewhere, but in case people haven't seen that, it's fantastic the way that they have, you know, the like the very first monster that shows up is just a floppy looking dragon that doesn't blink, his mouth doesn't open and close. It really looks like it's just a neck that's suspended in front of the Sumation costume, mm-hmm. in the same way that you know, it really, you probably wouldn't actually see an Ultraman monster that looked like that nowadays, but maybe in the 70s you would.
Actually, well, I'm going to be that guy, unfortunately. But all right, there was
go for it.
Yeah, there was Femigon from, you know, who showed up again in Ultraman Mebius about 10 years ago, who has a similar design to that.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, not super recent, but, you know.
Was it Mebius that had a, because there's one series that's not that old, honestly, where they have like this dragon monster that is totally like one of those where it's just like a neck and head, and I can't remember.
There's also a dinosaur too from Mebius as well. I'm trying to remember anybody recent.
Yeah, well, I mean, when you're dealing with the classic kaiju, they're not going to change the designs for the sequel series, but. Like, you wouldn't get a new monster like that in Tokusatsu.
I just had to be that guy, though. Come on.
Sure. much appreciated.
The first monster actually looks like a lot of designs from other Nishikawa stuff, too. Like, if you guys have his art books, there's a... I want to say either Destroya or maybe G2K, but there's a couple designs that, like, have that similar build with the huge neck and, like, kind of hulking shoulders and it's just the proportions and stuff. But it's really cool that he's...
A Boggin design like that too.
Hmm.
Oh, I was wondering if there was a Boggin design like that too, because I know a lot of Nishikawa's Boggin designs became Ultra Kaiju.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of the stuff got, you know, recycled, but
oh, I was thinking of Natsuno Meru from Max is the one.
Yeah, that's another one. I was picturing that one too, but I didn't know the name.
Yeah, like, which, because, I mean, I love that, with the way that monster, like, looks overall, despite the fact that it is literally just, like, a head and a neck on a string attached to a guy in a suit, so, but yeah, I mean, it's a great-looking creature, so.
So after Baby Dan Dan plays, we get this awesome piano instrumental. What happens next?
Yeah, so.
The world is repaired and saved. Gridman and the Hyper Agents go back to the Hyper World with Alexis in tow.
Right,
imprisoned
in this little like pixel cube, which is the exact same like pixel cube that they used for Kilikon in the original.
Mm-hmm. And then we have this really emotional scene between Rika and Akane, and Akane's leaving, and I think that gets us to the next really big, I guess I'd call it a reveal for the show.
It wasn't really a surprise, but I for some people it might have been, I guess.
Like, I'll say this, I was expecting it, but I think I was expecting it to be way more over the top with a live action fight between Alexis and Gridman, but Akane wakes up and we see the real person. It's an actor, much like the original show, it's live action. And then we kind of see where the other characters end up as she leaves the digital world to be on its own, including it.
Yeah, so a lot to unpack there. Maybe we can start with Ante because it's a smaller thing. What do you take about him having a new eye?
I've got two ideas. One, I like to think it kind of represents his ultimate evolution from just monster of the week bad guy to, you know, hero.
Mm-hmm.
The more literal idea is Gridman repaired him when he did the healing beam.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's mostly my take on it.
Well, and that's also the part that I was thinking about earlier, because that's the other thing, right? Is so at the end, like Ante meets up with Anocelius too. Right, and that's another part that had a lot of like Kaiju Max like resonance for me, right? Because like basically, like, you know, they have this kind of moment, and he's just like, "You're a Kaiju, like I am," and she's just like, "Yep, I'm just like you," you know. And she's like, "I also come from a family of monsters that learn to like pay their debts," you know, because like they sort of have this conversation about how, like, you know, you can be a Kaiju in this world as long as you know basically learn to like, you know, pay your debts, by which they mean like do good, you know. So and everything, and you get this shot of like Anocelius from the original series, you know, which that's the one thing I have a question about, because that's really weird to me. Because so Anocelius 2, so she's clearly supposed to be like the daughter or whatever of like the first Anastelius, but she's also wearing like the t-shirt that like the Computoid from that same episode is wearing. Mm-hmm. So are we supposed to infer that like Anastelius and this Computoid like had a kid?
Yes.
Okay.
I guess, or I mean, since they're all computer programs, I'm assuming they could change their shape and form if, you know, they're programmed that way, so to speak. That's their function. Yeah. Like, I can't see Rika
they
or
did
Utsumi
the dirty
doing
and
that.
They had a kid, man. That's
yeah.
what.
Okay. Okay. They fuck.
Yeah.
I mean, because she is a monster, because, like, they even make that. I mean, they had that point because, like, when she first meets Yuta and everything, and he's just like, he doesn't, like, he's really incredulous. He's like, you're a kaiju or whatever. And she, like, really briefly, like, turns, like, gigantic just to, like, prove it to him or whatever. So, you know, she's clearly, like, a kaiju in human form, much like Auntie. So,
did you like the role of her character? Because she's so limited. And her, like, for me, the main thing that she does is she provides some exposition that the world isn't quite the way we think it is. Like, if I remember right, I feel like for her, it was the first time that it was revealed in the show, pretty on the nose, that like not everything is the way that it seems. But is that something that was necessary for you guys? Like, do you feel like that was a major contribution, or is that just kind of like a thing that's there?
I was surprised by how early it came in the series, but I appreciate it being there. It is fan service. It is something that is probably going to be confusing as hell to people that don't know anything about the original series.
And that's me, right? Cause like yeah. I watched a handful of Gridman episodes actually. So I had an idea of what I was getting into, but when I saw this character, I never put together what she was.
Mm-hmm. And she shows up like from the first episode, but just in crowd shots in the background. So the idea is that she's around the whole time.
Yeah, because that's like what, like, again, because it's one of those things from like the Tokusatsu series that they don't really do a whole lot with. But you're supposed to understand that like the Anoceliuses, like there's supposed to be a lot of them, and like they're kind of like, I guess, like the guard dogs or whatever for like the digital world, and so they're kind of like everywhere. And so she's supposed to be the one, I guess, that's in charge of this area. And yeah, there's People have done this. I know I've sent those pictures to like Connor and Kevin, because like people have gone back already through the series, and like, you know, when she tells Yuta, she's like, oh, you know, I've always been around. Like, she has literally always been around. Like, in every episode, there's like crowd shots and stuff where, like, if you're not looking for her, which why would you? You would miss it. So
cool. That makes sense, and I think is actually pretty helpful. But also, as you mentioned, I think confusing for some of us who weren't as familiar with the original show. Before going,
which is the weird thing, because it's like on the one hand, it's like you want to recommend this show to people even if they've never watched the Tokusatsu series, because like that's always kind of like a turn off. I know if people are like, well, you know, here's this really great thing, but you need to have seen this other thing in order to kind of like get it. But in a you know, kind of true for this show, I feel like, you know, and If you're not a fan of that kind of stuff, I don't know. I mean, you know, I did have a funny moment with a mutual friend where we were talking on Facebook about this, and you know, I was asking him like, have you watched like SSSS Gridman yet? And he was like, no. He's like, I'm going to get around to it. And I guess a friend of his who's not a fan of like kaiju stuff was like, oh, I tried to watch that. He goes, it seemed kind of boring. Like, it was a Monster of the Week thing. I was just like, you don't say.
That was a critique I was hearing from some anime fans, where they're like, oh, this is too Monster of the Week. And like, but that's a selling point for me.
Yeah.
I was actually a little surprised by how un-Monster of the Week it was.
Yeah, I was going to say, like, for me, I was going to, it doesn't necessarily feel Monster of the Week-ish, because there's like a, there's this ongoing story arc, and the characters actually have like a lot of, I don't know, when I think, like, when you have long shows like Ultraman, for me, one of the biggest downsides is that they're so self-contained, they can't always build the entire season, whereas, like, this has a point with every episode that it's trying to get across and advance the story, which is why I liked it so much, I think.
Well, it's that really great thing where, like, it's also why people miss the fact that something like, you know, Evangelion, or even, you know, we mentioned like Big O earlier, are also shows that are like patterned after like Ultraman and like Monster of the Week shows. But the difference is that there is so much like character and like plot development going on that you kind of miss the fact that, like, you know, another part, one of the selling points is like each episode you'll be introduced to a different monster that will be defeated within the space of that particular show. You know, whereas, you know, with a lot of the Ultraman shows that are, they're great, you know, but because like character development is kind of so limited in those shows, you know, they can become repetitive at times, and you notice the Monster of the Week format more. So
I got to ask too, going back to Akane waking up, like, what was your takeaway from that? Like, what ran through your head when that happened?
Well, in my head, that's the real Akane. Everything we saw was in the computer world. And since this is a sequel, I just thought, well, yeah, she lives in the same world as the previous protagonist. Just made her own, you know, copy world full of copyroids. And Alexis took advantage of that. Green Man tried to stop him. That's basically all I took away from it.
Yeah, I mean, there is some clues around her room. Of, you know, for an example, I think she had a Space Patrol Luluco plush, which, like, okay, well, like, Rika's mom has that eyeball thing where she, it's a lot like one of the characters in Space Patrol Luluco, and it's the same voice actress. And she had, like, an Inferno Cop poster, and, like, yeah, Alexis is a little bit designed similarly to Inferno Cop. And you could just be like, okay, well, maybe she, you know, designed this world very similarly to be like her hobbies. So all of the weird little Easter eggs that we are intentional, like, she's a nerd who's done all these things. Now, there's a, if you want to get super nerdy with it, and this is going to open it up another bag of worms, and we have different interpretations on this, which could not necessarily contradict each other. So Justin, you pointed out that when she wakes up, she's wearing a white sweater, and throughout the entire series she has been wearing a purple sweater.
Mm-hmm.
And we associate white with the image of purity and innocence, and purple with the sort of more mature, darker themed types of things.
In Japan specifically, purple's associated with, well, like a lot of other places in the world too, but like royalty and stuff. So, and yeah.
Yeah. So I think that this, you know, demonstrates a change of her output, her character arc of, like, she's been cleansed somehow from going through this experience. There's the matter of her character design, which you can look up entire articles about how a lot of the characters in this are designed similarly to Transformers characters, and we can get into some of that later. But specifically, Akane is Optimus Prime from the Shattered Glass universe, which is the Optimus Prime goes evil and tries to take over the world one. And he's purple in that. But then when he is redeemed and turns into Nova Prime, he's white again. So it's one of those, like, okay, this is a weird little, like, goofy Easter egg, but it also has some, like, character foreshadowing significance too.
Okay.
Yeah, because she's got the one of her, she wears a pair of glasses at one point, and the one of the lenses gets cracked, which is exactly what Optimus looks like before redemption.
Yeah, which is also, like, it shows that she has a skewed perspective on the world. You know, a character with a cracked eyeglass lens is a usual sort of visual key that people use in media of, like, oh, this person's off kilter. They don't see things clearly, so to speak. But also, Rika wears a white sweater. And Justin, you were saying that you think that she looks like Rika, right?
Yeah, my thing was that, like, when you first see her wake up, like, I thought that she looked a lot like Rika as, like, an actual character. And I actually think it's sort of striking that if you look at all the character designs for the show, you know, I mean, show kind of looks like a normal person too. But, you know, I mean, a lot of the characters, and especially Yuta and Akame and stuff, you know, I mean, they stand out as like kind of really kind of like classical anime characters. But then, yeah, I mean, like Akame and Rika have like this whole sort of like weird relationship with each other where like Akame, you know, really wants Rika to like her, and, you know, talks about like, I programmed you to like me, you know, you don't have a choice, and everything, you know, like we're supposed to be best friends. And she's like, you know, when they have that final confrontation, you know, before Akame becomes like a kaiju and then is absorbed by Alexis, a lot of it is about how Akane is like really sort of hurt that, you know, like this whole perfect world that she's built has like come apart at the seams, but she seems specifically hurt by the fact that, like, you know, she's failed to make, like, you know, her relationship with Rika work. And I was wondering if maybe part of what we're supposed to get from the end of that too is that, like, part of the significance of Rika was that Akane created a perfect world in which there was a version of herself in it that she could like.
Yeah, and so they're absolutely foils, and I noticed this going through on the second watch through. I mean, Rika's look is actually modeled after Megatron, who is a foil for Optimus Prime.
Right.
But there's so many things of, you know, their houses are right next to each other in one of the dream worlds. Rika's mom is Akane's mom. They talk about how they always took the bus together, how they were always together when they were younger. One thing that particularly stood out to me was there's a scene where Rika lets one of her two friends, I can't remember which one it was, one of them copy her homework, and they're like, oh, thank God. And like, did you just say, oh, thank God?
Yeah,
like little sense. Things like that where...
Yeah. Well, there's the end scene, too, where they're having their conversation. You have Rika that you have Akane, who's basically sobbing and crying and saying how terrible she is and how she's so much of a screw up. And she's just like pouring it out. And Rika saying, I know. And she's basically like comforting her and assuring her, I know who you are. And like, I accept you. And like, she's accepting herself essentially.
Yeah. And then Rika gives this, this pass case to Akane, which has the Autobots matrix of leadership on it. But, it's the same one that she has. It's like, here, you can be like me now. And there's an entirely reasonable reading of this. It's like, so this is really a story of someone learning to love themselves in a very Evangelion sort of way.
Yeah, I mean, that's a fair... I was curious what other like Ava stuff you found, because I mean, we did that our entire like Ava episode. There's so much imagery in this show that almost feels like it's the same, but also almost opposite.
Mm-hmm.
Like how Shinji's always talking about, I mustn't do this or whatever. And in this case, it's like Yuka's saying, I have to do this. I have a thing that I got to do. And then like, what else did you see in this show that was also like referencing Ava?
There were just a couple of shots that stood out to me here and there. Like the scene where Akane is in the elevator, for an example, was parallel to the ridiculous elevator scene in Ava.
Yeah.
There's a bit where they're in the cemetery where the way that they're blocked is just identical to another Evangelion shot. Yeah, a handful of minor details like that, and then just a lot of the overall tone and feeling of it in terms of, you know, both are things about depression, but, you know, Evangelion pulls so much from Ultraman anyway that...
Yeah, I mean, that's fair, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those things where it's like post-Evangelion. I mean, because that's just the whole thing about Evangelion, you know, and it's like Evangelion was one of those series that was so popular and so influential that like you can't escape it now. You know, it's like what James Bond did for like the spy genre, where if you're not, you know, consciously or unconsciously aping it, then even if you're trying not to, then you're in effect still like responding to it by like going in like the opposite direction, which is what you see in something like, you know, like Big O, where they said like they very intentionally wanted to go in the opposite direction of Evangelion, even though you can make an argument that the end of Big O like one-ups Evangelion and you're like, what the fuck endings? So but like, you know, like but you know, I mean like me and Connor were like joking about this before too, because it's like, if you haven't read the Ultraman manga that's getting ready to be turned into an anime series on Netflix. Yeah, Netflix later this year. Like, yeah, Connor, you were joking about how like, are you ready for all of like the articles that are going to come out that are just going to be like, oh, this is like Iron Man meets Evangelion.
Yeah, it's going to happen. I remember when Gridman came out, there was like a lot of Eva and Shin Godzilla interpretations of it, and everyone's like, no. Everyone else on Twitter was like, no, this is Ultraman, man, or well, Gridman. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think one of the things that
just
like
small reference pools.
One of the things that struck me too, though, is the way I felt about it, because like I kept getting this Ava vibe, but actually, like this time, instead of feeling like I want to, this sulking feeling like Shinji, this was much more hopeful.
Yeah,
and that's why I think I like this show so much more. If that makes
it's,
any sense.
It's definitely, yeah. It's definitely not. Yeah, I mean, Gridman is. I get what you're talking about, Matt, because I feel like it hits a lot of the same themes. And like same kind of like issues as like Evangelion, like it's using, Evangelion is using like, you know, the raw material kind of like of a Tsuburaya show to tell this story about like, you know, depression and existential crisis and kind of stuff. Whereas Gridman is literally using the material from a Tsuburaya show, and it's also dealing with those same kinds of themes. But like it ends on like a much more kind of like hopeful and sort of like conventional note. So, but yeah, which I mean, I think there are different reasons for that. I mean, and in some ways, I think that you could argue that Gridman is more hopeful because it's also more of a more conservative show than what Anno, I think, is trying to do with Evangelion, because I feel like a lot of Evangelion is Anno trying to, you know, say certain things about Japanese society that he doesn't like. So.
Yeah, sorry. I think Amemiya feels like Anno before Anno broke.
So. sorry, we got off on a tangent there. I was just kind of curious because that was the vibe I was getting. Maybe I was totally wrong. Like I saw that shot in the cemetery. I'm like, oh, that's like. Almost, that's the whole parents thing. All the, you know, the mother died and whatnot, and there were different things that I saw, and I was like, oh, okay, this, I don't know, it struck a nerve and a chord, and I think.
You there?
I guess we lost him.
Did we lose Matt?
I'm here.
I'm still here.
I'm back.
Oh, all right.
I don't know. Anyway, it's 2:00. I'm rambling, but my main point overall is like I like the fact that this show has this. This connection with what I consider redemption, like that speaks to me specifically. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's what I took from it the most.
Yeah.
I agree with that. And I think that's a better, better theme to take from it than what so many other people seem to be taking, which is, Rika got thick thighs.
God, is that also a thing?
Yeah.
Oh yeah. Well, that's what I don't know how much you're aware of that. Matt.
I mean, that was... Incredibles 2 made me aware of.
Well, I mean, that's what I was kind of alluding to earlier, which is that, yeah, I mean, like, you know, they, I mean, I've seen like, you know, charts where like people have talked about like, you know, how you design like the perfect like anime like Bushoujo or whatever, and I mean, I swear to God, like the character designers on this show like just like executed that with like I said earlier, like lethal precision. So because you know, and there are interviews that I've seen where like apparently like this was completely intentional, was that they just wanted like Akame and Rika to be like the most attractive like teenage girls you could imagine, and like they you know, while not being like the same girl, and you know, I mean they arguably are too successful. So I feel like we're getting into like another Asuka and Rei like scenario here. So
yeah, I mean they rushed Dakimakura, which are the pillows with the anime characters on them. they rushed those to market before the action figures of Gridman himself. So I think that,
yeah,
says
that's hilarious. Can I ask though? This is something that, because like I watch enough anime. This isn't something like, but like I don't watch everything that comes out. Like these are supposed to be junior high girls. They're like, does that make you? To me, that's a bit creepy. Maybe it's just the thing I don't understand. But I'm like, I don't want to feel like she's got thick thighs.
See, I'm pretty inoculated to it, where it didn't even register that like these are characters that are supposed to be sexy until people started talking about how sexy they were. But apparently it was quite a thing, because Tsuburaya made a whole big kerfuffle on their website about doujinshi, which is traditionally not been much of an issue for them. Doujinshi are unlicensed fan comics. Historically, lots of people have done them. They sell them in limited quantities. They don't care about violating the copyright. All of a sudden, when this show comes out, they're like, "Hey guys, you can't make unauthorized works with our characters. We'll go after you if you do doujinshi." And it seems like they're just trying to crack down on fan art of these particular girls.
Well, yeah, that's an important point, which is that you definitely can't say, I mean, it's not a one-to-one thing, like, not all doujinshi is, like, ecchi or hentai, but, like, there's a fair amount of it that is, you know,
yeah.
Because obviously, I mean, if you're letting fans do fan comics, then, you know, obvious, I mean, it's just like anything else, it's just like any kind of other fan art or fan fiction, right? I mean, you know, if the actual thing itself is not giving you, like, you know, quote unquote, like sexy images of characters who you find attractive, then you're going to create those for yourself and other fans' consumption. So, you know, to get to Matt's thing, you know, this is a subject that I've actually like done a lot of reading on and like done some work on because of like, you know, some of my other like academic interests, and like I did a lot of work for like my master's thesis and everything dealing with like otaku and like moe culture and stuff. And you know, my whole thing about it is, it's like, yes, like absolutely, you know, these characters, you know, whether it's like Sailor Moon or Rei and Asuka or Rika and Akame, like they are supposed to be like junior high or like, you know, teenage girls and stuff, you know, that in real life this would be reprehensible and everything. But there is this, you know, because it's anime, there's like this disconnect sort of thing where it's, you know, it's like, well, they're not real children, you know. So and in so many ways, like not just, you know, like even the way they're characterized, I mean, you know, they're arguably not real children. They don't necessarily look like real children, you know, they don't act like real children necessarily. So, you know, it's this weird sort of thing where, you know, it's just like, you know, they're anime characters, you know, and like they're attractive, you know, and like they're young and they're sort of like youthful and everything, you know, and it's, I don't get on anybody who doesn't understand it or doesn't think that it's, you know, who does feel like uncomfortable about it. But at the same time, it's like the sort of thing, it's like, I guess the simplest way to put it is like, at least from my perspective, is it's like, you know, if somebody tells me like, you know, they think like, you know, Rika or Akame is attractive, it's like, that doesn't immediately for me just go like, oh, you know, pedophile, you know? So like, it's not,
yeah, I get,
yeah.
It's like, yes. Balance thing. I also would never buy a pillow, so.
No, I wouldn't either. Like, yeah, that's not, yeah, I would not buy a pillow with, like, these characters on it, you know. But at the same time, it's like, you know, I can say, like, I think that they're, like, attractively drawn female characters, you know. So, and that clearly that was intentional, you know, on their part to make them, like, attractive, you know.
Well, go ahead. Definitely during that swimming beach episode, I guess, like there are some camera angles that there's no looking around it.
Yeah, I mean that there's a lot of that too, like the way that you'll have the female character standing like right in front of the camera, but like basically right at the skirt level, and then looking up at the guy as he's talking across to her, and that happens. I mean, which is a common thing. Like, fan service is a thing that happens all over the place. But I don't know. It's always been the thing for me that, like, don't really get it. It's fine, I guess. It's sort of confusing because, like, I want to be able to relate to the characters. And for me, that's something that sort of takes me out of it. At the same point, like, the narratives and the way that the characters' storylines play out, like, that's what I'm most interested in. So I don't let the other stuff bug me as much.
I mean, it is. I mean, it's. I guess, like, the thing about it is, like, it is always, like, this weird thing because, like, I do that all the time when I'm watching, like, these kinds of shows, you know, and especially, like, anime. And this is true about some American animated series, too, though, is, like, because, like, these characters are supposed to be children, but they're not written or even always drawn like children. It is kind of bizarre because, you know, it's like you'll be watching this show, you know, as like somebody in like your 20s or you know, in my case, you know, like your 30s, and you're watching this and then you're just like, oh yeah, you know, I get these characters, like I kind of relate to them and everything, you know, and then it's just like, by the way, like they're 13, and you're just like, no, the fuck they're not. it's like no 13-year-old is like, you know, doing this, you know, so it is a little it's a little strange at times, so, you know, and I chalk that up, of course, to part of the fact that, you know, again, it's that whole thing where, I mean, these are shows that are being written by adults themselves, so, you know, why would they be able to necessarily accurately reflect, like, you know, what it's like, you know, to be a child, so.
The fantasy of teenagers standing around in a store reading Uchusen and quizzing each other on stats of Ultra Kaiju.
Yeah, I mean, exactly. You know, I mean, what you just kind of said there, Kevin, I mean, that's one way to think about it, too, is like all of this kind of stuff, you know, you can think about it as it's like it is part of like that adult fantasy that you have when you reach a certain age where you're just like, boy, you know, if I was who I was now, but, you know, I had like my youth and stamina and looks of when I was like 16, you know, like that's like your ideal person kind of. So, you know, but yeah, I mean, that's my whole thing is it's like, I don't begrudge anybody, you know, necessarily. I mean, there are limits, you know, I think for every person about like how far you want to take that. I mean, I have photos somewhere of a car that I ran into in a Barnes & Noble parking lot. I don't mean that literally. I didn't run into it. I was walking through a Barnes & Noble parking lot going to my car, and I stopped because there was this car that was like covered. I mean, like plastered in like bumper stickers that was all just like moe etche, like anime stuff. And I'm just like, this is somebody who not only thinks anime girls are attractive, but like really is proud of it. but at the same time, I also have had the experience of I was actually driving to a friend's birthday party once, and there was this car in front of me, and I noticed the frame that they had around their license plate, and I got to the party, and I was just like, so I said, interesting thing, the car in front of me had a license plate frame on it for Brazzers, and every guy there just had the reaction that you just had, and every girl there went, what?
Yeah, that's usually how that works, I think.
Yeah. So
back to Gridman.
Yeah. But yeah. So you know, yeah, Gridman. I mean, we could talk a little bit more, I guess, about the. I mean, Kevin, you brought up the Transformers thing, so.
Actually, pretty interesting. Yeah. Which I didn't know anything. I didn't know about it. The design concepts being basically the same.
Yeah, like that was, I'm not a big Transformers person either, and that was something I became aware of through Tumblr, and what we were supposed to have Andy on for, because he's evidently a big Transformers fan, but apparently, like, pretty much every character in this show, just about, is, like, their outfits and stuff are based on a Transformer, so.
And they're not, like, the usual Transformers, they're the Shattered Glass alternate universe convention exclusive repaint type of Transformers. But yeah, so like,
or in some case the Michael Bay movie Transformers, because the junior high Neon Genesis junior high kids are based off of the Dinobots from Age of Extinction.
Right. Yeah, but like Yuta's like a cliff jumper, and I'll just pull up this page here. Utsumi's like Sideswipe. We already talked about Rika and Akane. Anti is similar to Rodimus, and even has the same weapon. He has that like weird like circular saw thing that he pulls out when he gets attacked by Alexis later on, and like that was that's one of Rodimus's weapons, you know, on top of, you know, having that whole thing where he's like a sort of navy color with purple flames and whatnot. Yeah, Rika's mom, on top of having that eyeball thing from Space Patrol Luluco, has a Megatron sticker on her apron, which goes along with, you know, Megatron being the basis for Rika's design. Namiko is based on Starscream, based both in her colored design, and she has one of the Cyber Planet keys as her hair clip, which I don't know exactly what that means. That's just what it says here. But we can also talk about, you know, Namiko, her name, as in arguably close to Namco or to Konami. Then her friend is Haas, as in Hasbro.
I was going to say Hasbro.
Yeah, and she's based on Soundwave. So she's the one that has the mask over her mouth because Soundwave doesn't have a mouth. And she has the blue blanket with Ravage on it.
Which is the cassette that Soundwave keeps inside of him as Ravage.
Yeah. There's, you know, a background girl that's based on Thundercracker. Going back to the names, so in the first episode, the girls that get killed are Tonkawa and Toiko. So Tonka and Toiko are other manufacturers of transforming robot toys, as well as if you get to the, oh gosh, the four guys, I don't remember the names. One of them was Yamato, but they were all also named after toy companies, the ones that had like the YouTube channel. So they definitely like get into it with all of these.
The guys from the YouTube channel that show up in that one episode are they're all based on alt versions of Starscream. I remember that.
Oh, okay.
So it's like it's literally like four Starscreams like hanging out with each other.
That's fantastic. Yeah, I'm not seeing their names easily on where I'm searching through, but yeah, so it's just like all of those little things are references, along with like what I mentioned before with the Shattered Glass Optimus Prime character arc thing that goes on there, which I think is where it's actually most important. But if you look at like the desks at Studio Trigger, they just have like toys lying around all over the place. And then they have all sorts of, you know, little Tsuburaya Easter eggs scattered throughout the entire show as well.
Yeah, there's quite a few there.
I mean, starting with Tonkawa, because we're just talking about her keychain, Ultraman Nexus fans mm-hmm. might already get a sense of where her storyline is going.
Kanade has a ton of obscure kaiju in her room. Probably the most obscure, in my opinion, is that monster head she's got on top of her shelf is apparently Nerogiris from Fireman, which is a pretty deep cut. Mm. There's also a lot of stuff in the in the Dream episode, like Seven Durek, and you can see Jumborg 9 there, and the Terranoid from Dinah, and countless other stuff.
I thought that was the stupid, wonderful pun instead of Mondarake and Seven Durek. But they have a couple of others, like instead of going to 7-Eleven, they go to 721, and instead of Starbucks, they're Starbos.
Yeah, that was. I like the Starbos one, that was funny.
Mm-hmm. Starbos was a deep cut. I had to actually look up information on that show. a handful of Sorry, it's late at night, so my
phone's
not
We've only been recording for like 4 hours, so at some point it has to end.
Yeah, this typical Mazer Patrol type of shenanigans.
Didn't you and Justin, do like an 8 hour one on Lovecraft in Japan once?
We did. That was perhaps ill advised.
I don't even know how you did that.
I don't either. That was something that we had like worked out like months in advance. Like we had like you know, printouts and stuff where we were just like, all right, this is how we're gonna do it, you know. And like I think we both thought this was gonna be like, oh, this will just be like, you know, like 2 hours or something, and then somehow like 8 hours later, like we're still talking.
I feel like this episode and probably that episode required some heavy editing.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, I mean I think the point stands without having like Andy or somebody here to do like more exposition on it, that because of the Tanaka or Takarada, whatever, I can't remember it now, the connection to the people who made Transformers, there's a lot of Transformer references.
Yeah, so a lot of Transformer references, a lot of Tsuburaya references, because again, this is a Tsuburaya thing. They are evidently pretty big Tsuburaya fans for throwing in things here and there that you would not expect to see, you know, casually, just like, oh, there's a Spark Doll symbol or whatnot. And yes, sometimes it could actually wind up being something that's a little bit of foreshadowing or plot relevant, but usually not in an obvious way that it doesn't automatically click. Like,
yeah, know. I mean, if I hadn't seen like posts about it on Tumblr, like I would have never realized that like the characters were based on Transformers, or even that the Neon Genesis Junior High School students were supposed to be the Dinobots. Like, but it's one of those things that like once you get it pointed out to you, just like, oh well, yeah, like, there's no denying that. Like, this isn't like some crazy like fan theory. This is like, oh, they are deliberately referencing this stuff. So
yeah. Or before we started recording, Connor, you brought up that one Ultraman Cosmos. Like,
yeah, Chaos Jirak.
Yeah. So it's just one of the names that she happens to drop while she's going through the list of monsters, but it's not an arbitrary one.
No, it's a very significant one. In fact, I think Hasegawa actually wrote that episode too.
When what's the significance of that?
At one point, Akane drops the name of an Ultraman Cosmos monster, Chaos Jirak, in the episode where she meets Izumi and they're bonding over that issue of Uchusen. And Chaos Jirak in that episode of Cosmos was like this whale created by the main villain, the Chaos Setter, and it was manipulating this girl's dream. And when they reference that, I'm like, oh, okay, that's a neat little reference to Ultraman Cosmos. And then I learned later that I completely missed that the girl in that episode who was being manipulated, her name was Akane. And Hasegawa wrote that episode too.
Also, that issue of Uchusen that they're looking in, I remember that on the cover they have Tsurugi from Ultraman Mabius.
Mm-hmm. There's Andromelos.
And they have the training armor of Ultraman Zero.
Tector gear.
Yeah, so these are all initial forms, or, you know, something like initial forms that you see that is holding back the true form of an Ultraman that they eventually are... What I read that is that that's our promise that, hey, Gridman's going to get an upgrade. We're going to see a real Gridman down the road.
Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, nothing, you know, I mean, there's that adage that you hear about when you study like film theory and stuff, that like, you know, nothing put on screen is ever like an accident, but like this is living proof of that in this case. So that, like, yeah, this is clearly the people at Trigger are incredibly methodical. So
yeah, so it's just really impressive. The deeper that you look at it, the deeper it gets. So that's, I've not seen a show that is satisfying on that sort of level for quite a while.
Watch Gridman. It's great.
Please watch it. It's really, really good.
Yeah, it's a great series, and it shows, you know, not to get into other topics, though Kevin alluded to it at the beginning, but it shows how well the medium of tokusatsu can be applied to animation when you have, you know, when done right.
You hear that, Toho?
It's up there with my favorite adaptations of tokusatsu to anime. Like, it's up there with Garo the Animation. It's up there with Iria. Like, it's one of the ones where I'm looking forward to as soon as a Blu-ray set comes out. I'm going to buy it. I really, 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 really hope that Funimation doesn't skimp on the extras.
Please don't.
There's a fellow, Mike Dent, who's been writing amazing summaries of the episodes, just sort of explaining all of the nuances, and he has written to Funimation being like, hey, I want to preserve this stuff because I'm just writing it on Twitter for some reason. Can you please include this in your extra features? And I hope that they do. And Tsuburaya seems pretty amenable to this sort of stuff. Trigger also seems super chill. So hopefully there wouldn't be a problem with that. So I hope they make that happen. Because too often I'm anticipating what the extras are going to be is the Funimation voice actors doing an audio commentary like, this show sure is weird. Think it's based on a video game? Like something like that.
Uh-huh. What kind of Evangelion Power Rangers stuff is this?
How do you guys like my Tim Curry impression?
That's good.
That was pretty good.
That is a good Tim Curry.
Did you since you mentioned Mike Dent's Twitter, did you guys see the he re-edited this to match the Superhuman Samurai Cyber Squad opening?
I did not see that.
That is amazing.
All right, well, that can go into the show notes.
Yeah. So kind of fun. Yeah. So I have to, I'll send it to you all because it's I posted it on Facebook, so, but I don't think it's on like YouTube or anything. So like everything else, like you said, for some reason it's on Twitter. So I don't care for Twitter, but
Anyway.
Anyway, but yeah. So yeah, I think that's a ringing endorsement from everybody for Gridman.
Yeah, all right. Watch it.
Please watch it. Like, if you're going to watch one anime or tokusatsu thing that just came out, please watch Gridman.
All right.